You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. You're trying to save me, stop holding your breath. And you think I'm crazy, yeah, you think I'm crazy.
I wanted to fame, but not the cover of Newsweek. Oh well, guess beggars can't be choosy. Wanted to receive attention from my music.
Good Wednesday morning to you. Mike McNamara in for Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio. Hope you're having a good one so far, wherever you are. Dodgers went up 1-0 in the World Series last night. 103 at game time. Welcome to November. You know, the cool part is when it's played on the West Coast, weather's irrelevant, man. It's going to be in the 70s. Houston's got a, I think they got a ceiling that they close. Or is it domed all the time? One of the two, so weather's, it's relevant in California, but hell, when it's 100 degrees in November, I'm not sure that's an issue. But the World Series, if you're a baseball fan, always cool to watch. Especially with probably the two best teams in baseball in it, truth be told. Cleveland could have made an argument, but gotta play your way in there, boys. The tons of stuff in the news. Most of it bad. Bo Bergdahl gonna get sentenced today. So we'll get to hear how he's a victim in all of this, and none of what he did was his fault, and it was the Army's fault, and blah, 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 blah. You know, the other thing that I find in the news the last 24 hours, and, you know, many people will find it heartwarming, but, you know, this parade of Gold Star wives on television is not a good thing. I watched a little bit of it just to see how Fox would treat the interview. And she, I think they played most of her comments relative to what she said about the president. And then she started to speak about her husband, and they played a snippet of that he spoke five languages. And I'm trying to think, if I was her and I sat down with him and said that, look, I'd be happy to do it, but, you know, I'd like to include this in the interview. And then she sees the way Fox edited it. I wonder if she thought, why did I do that? And so that's why the whole issue of, you know, Gold Star families, very, very inappropriate for it to be in the news like it is today. So, I don't know, it's just kind of icky and disgusting. I got an email early today, MAC-3 carrier battle groups in the Pacific. Is that a big deal? It depends. 2 is the normal number. Where are they located? That's probably a big deal. So normally when one's headed out there, one comes home and they kind of do this passing. Now, if that's not the case, I'm not familiar with their deployment schedule, but if that's not the case, and there's 3 out there, then that is a statement. And so, so film at 11. More to come on that. So anyway, I thought I'd speak to that. But yeah, big news. Evidently, the sentencing piece of the Bo Bergdahl case is going to happen today, or at least he's taking testimony from people that were impacted by going out and searching for him. And, you know, one of the things I don't understand, I read something that was written in the Baltimore Sun yesterday by a public affairs officer from that battalion. And he said soldiers signed non-disclosure agreements with the Army. What is that? I don't know why, but it seems like the Army really struggles. I mean, put the truth out there, man. Because you look, it always makes you look. And they went down this road with the whole Pat Tillman thing. Why do they do that? Why do they try to control this and manage it in some way, shape, or form? Because it always bites them in the ass. You know, in my opinion, the Marine Corps tends to do it the right way. It's like, let the truth rip, and we'll go from there. But, you know, people will accept you taking your face shots and moving forward. What they don't accept is attempts to manage the truth, denials, stonewalling, and it just seems like, so I was reading this, and this guy was mad about it. And his point was he wanted to see Bo Bergdahl get his, because he put other people at risk, and that the army had managed this thing and massaged it, and the truth hadn't come out yet, and he was anxious to see if it would come out during this trial, and that hopefully at the sentencing portion they would finally get to hear what soldiers felt that were there. So, anyway, so it'll be an interesting morning. We'll check the OD headlines here in a minute, Marine Corps headlines, and then tell you what we're going to do today. I did an interview last year with Ron Baskowski. Ron he retired as a brigadier general from Marine Forces Pacific a couple years ago. I first met him when he was a first lieutenant, and I was a second lieutenant at the basic school. We were doing squad in the attack. That's right. And this first lieutenant shows up. And you immediately feel a kinship towards him because he's not a captain. He's a lieutenant. You're a lieutenant. Right? And so he showed up, you know, as a young guy, and he was a guy snapping in. He was, like, learning about the problem, which is not very difficult, teaching squad in the attack. But the thing he did that I will never forget is he built the first terrain model that I'd ever seen in my life. Yeah. Yeah, I'd never seen one. And I don't know, I don't know why. I don't know if other guys didn't build them. But I remember seeing him bust the sugar out of his MRE and make a trail out of it. He had string. He had some 3x5 cards that were laminated that he wrote on. You know, he just had all these little gadgets I'd never seen before. And I remember watching, you know, what he was doing and thinking, wow, what's this? And so then we get ready for the order, and, you know, he sits us behind the line of departure, you know, where we would certainly start from. And he walks us through the attack, right? And he's acting as a squad leader and giving the order. And I just remember being fascinated by the terrain model. Like, whoa, this is so cool. And then I remember walking in the attack, my squad in the attack, I remember walking and everything that he said. Here was the stream. On the other side of the stream, I saw these things. I was like, this is awesome. Who is this guy? So he and I have crossed paths periodically over the course of years, and Ron is a great guy, Naval Academy guy. And so he was in Beirut as part of BLT 1-8. I want to say he was Alpha Company. He was with Alpha Company 1-8, and they were deployed towards a city in a compound. And so you're going to hear from him about being on the ground that day, being a lieutenant, and what that was like. So we'll do that, and then we'll hear probably, there's the interview is a two-hour interview. So we might get two-thirds of the way through it, and then we're going to talk to Doug Lucio. I met Doug. He just written an article, Lieutenant Colonel Doug Lucio. But Lucky is he's instructing now on the East Coast in Norfolk. And and he's written an article. He was an advisor in Afghanistan. I think the article's entitled "The Vito Corleone Rules of Leadership." And so we're going to talk to him about advising, and then we'll ask him. We'll get his thoughts on. I know it's premature, but we'll get his thoughts on what he's seen relative to Nijjar. Because you know, under the broad heading of special forces, there's quite the array of units that fit into that. Special forces, you know, Green Berets are used most often to do partner operations to develop, right? But when you hear special forces, most people think, you know, they hear the James Bond music, right? They hear that music. Door kicking, direct action, all that. So there's a spectrum of special operations. Not everybody lives in the direct action part of that thing. You know, there's people that do all kinds of different things. And so Green Berets have, for a long, long time, have gone in and worked with developing nations' military to develop, to do what General Dunford said in his press conference the other day. When we step on them in Syria and they squirt, when they squirt into Nijjar, we want there to be a capability that knows how to communicate, that knows how to take these guys on, and how to kill them, so we don't have to. And that's the Green Berets do that. That's what these guys are doing. So we'll get Lucky's thoughts on it. And to me, it takes big balls to do that because you go live with them. And you know this, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan, I think most of us are familiar with the instances where Iraqis or Afghans have turned their weapons on advisors and killed them. And so it takes no small amount of courage to go out there and do that. So, and there's Americans doing it all over the world right now. So anyway, good Wednesday morning to you on a hump day. And we talk about Beirut. It's really, when you look back, it's the first major engagement that the United States has in this global war on terrorism, and we don't even really know it yet. You know, we're kind of I don't know. It certainly seems in many ways that we're neophytes to the whole event at that time. I mean, when you look at, honestly, bust out Google Earth and take a look at the, you know, the layout of the airport in Beirut, and then measure the distance between the Beirut and the Shouf Mountains. It's amazing. I mean, the Shouf Mountains are right on top of the airport, and the Marines were at the airport, so everything they did was observed. Everything. Everywhere they went, where they took ammunition, everything they did inside that compound could be easily observed by whoever decided to observe it. And so you look at that, and then, you know, the posture at the airport, you know, could have been, you know, an overreaction to negligent discharges, you know. And so Ronald explained some of that in the interview. So, but you look at the mission and, you know, it was the first major shot in the global war on terrorism that we continue to fight today. And to be honest with you, you've heard it, you know, we've all heard it described as a generational conflict. In fact, it might be a multi-generational conflict. Long after you and I are here, this war will probably still be going on between Islamic fundamentalism and Western culture or moderate cultures around the world. So, anyway, we have that going for us. The United States Marine Corps Band makes it official. Good morning to you. Daily Dose.
Country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
Mostly cloudy and 58 in Quantico. Sunny and 60 at Camp Lejeune. Got cold in Texas, 45 degrees, mostly sunny, in Granbury, Texas. You know something's wrong when it's warmer in Montana than it is in Texas. 55 and sunny in Big Timber, Montana. 29 Palms, sunny in 64. Camp Pendleton, sunny 60. Okinawa continues its cooling trend. Cloudy, dark 75. Rocca warmed up a little bit. Sunny in 82. Marcia, about the same. Dark, clear, 78 degrees. Excuse me. Currently, Farron 67 at the home of All Marine Radio. Looking for a high of 96 today. Yeah, no kidding. 84 tomorrow. It's going to cool off to 84 tomorrow and 82 on Friday. We'll take a quick break. We come back, Ron Baskowski. Actually, we'll go through the headlines real quick, and then Ron Baskowski, Brigadier General of the United States Marine Corps, joined me a year ago, and it's worth a second listen, trust me. So, sit back, relax, enjoy the next few hours. All Marine Radio, at your service. Whatever you do, don't touch that dial.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Matt.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nelson at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives.
Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOC community should be aware of.
The Global SOC Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsocfoundation.org/Marines.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, the we'll check the news report, news headlines real quick. There's an article in the this stuff is crazy. I guess it's just the society we live in now, but. Just a few headlines from What's Trending. This is from What's Trending on Marine Corps Time. No combat action ribbon, no respect. The push to end the ribbon rack divide. That's trending now. It's written in 2015. You know, again, the... that stuff has been going on forever in the Marine Corps. But good leaders are good leaders, and they create reputations, and so it goes. So, anyway, I just saw it, and I found it amusing. Other headlines from Marine Corps Town. Marines launch rockets from amphibious ships to destroy a land target 70 kilometers away. Well, congratulations. Why didn't the ship spend its ammunition on it? Concerns about Russia renew Marines' focus on MEF level warfighting. Another says we've got to be ready to fight Russia in Eastern Europe. Nice. Another headline. Niger is a central hub for U.S. counterterrorism in West Africa. I think we'll all learn more about that. If you have not watched the full press conference that General Dunford did the other day, I would tell you you should do so. The Marine Corps is launching a new survey to know why Marines reenlist or not. And that's about it. From the early bird, North Korea has tested a new solid fuel missile engine. So as Graham Newsom has told us, you know, they will consistently refine that capability until they have the capability to place a nuclear tip on a ICBM and with accuracy target the United States. So again, they continue. NBC News reported, I think most people have seen this, U.S. soldiers in Niger were pursuing an ISIS recruiter when they were ambushing. The other report you probably heard is that somebody in the village they were at betrayed him. Now, I made the comment when I first saw that report. Normally, the way this stuff happens is, and this is, I want to say, the first or second patrol these guys had done. So there's a lack of familiarity with the area and the people involved in it, and they don't know what's wrong when it's in front of them. Two, somebody betrays them. That's a key part of it. So that the force, the ambushing force is knows where they're at with certainty, and that's a part of it. So again, again, you don't need to have a crystal ball when you see this stuff happened repeatedly over the course of, 15, 16 years, and you've been part of at least the examination of the events that went into it, the same elements are in most of these. China has had just concluding their big party meetings, and the panda bear, Mr. Xi, he came out a winner. Yeah, and but the headline today is that he's looking to shake up the men running China's massive military machine, which is normally he's uncomfortable with somebody's power status. And then a story that caught my eye, and that is 1 in 4 troops sees white nationalism in the ranks. And those troops rate it as a larger national security threat than Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, which is a bit of an eye opener. So anyway, not that it isn't disturbing, it doesn't merit our attention. Obviously, if they say it is, it's something we should look into. Interesting. And the Marine Corps headlines, there are no new headlines. All the headlines in the early bird come out of Marine Corps Times, and you've already heard those. All right, Ron Baskowski joined us a year ago to talk about Beirut. He was the first lieutenant there, I believe with Alpha Company 1-8, maybe Weapons Company. I can't remember off the top of my head. So you'll hear from him right now.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue on a Monday, the 24th day of October, and a day that we remember the events of Beirut that happened 33 years ago. So Mike McNamara in with you on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. And good morning to you. And what you're going to hear next is an interview I did with Ron Baskowski. I met him. I was a lieutenant at the basic school. He had just come back from Lebanon. And, the Marine Corps wasn't fighting that other than those things in those days. So, we had heard he had been in Lebanon. And so, I remember we were doing a big squad in the attack. And he built the first terrain model I'd ever seen. So he's young first lieutenant. And Ron looks young, even now. I mean, you don't realize, I don't want to say he's old, but, you know, he's a young-looking guy. So the first lieutenant, he got there, and he looked like one of us. And he builds this train model, and, you know, he talked a little bit about his time in Beirut. And I want to say, you know, it's like we were lieutenants. We so much wanted to sit down and say, can you, what was it like? What happened? But anyway, that's where I first met him. And I've crossed paths with him, you know, since. And he's always been gracious to me as one of his basic school students. So here's an interview we did. It starts with his career. He's recently retired and as a brigadier general. Starts with his career. And then we talk about Beirut. So on a day we remember it, he was there as an infantry officer in 1-8. And he talks about the complexities, how small it was, being at the airport or being at one of the remote locations where they had companies and small groups of Marines. You can see what a precarious situation that any of them were in. And so you're going to hear from Ron Baskowski right now on a day that we remember the events of 33 years ago yesterday in Beirut, Lebanon. So good morning to you. Here is General Baskowski.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
/7:34 here on a Monday morning. All Marine Radio continues. Yeah, suffice it to say I'm pissed. Okay. And so joining me to hopefully help me out is Brigadier General Ron Baskowski, United States Marine Corps retired. Ron, first of all, thanks for coming on this morning. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Mac. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. First of all, I want to talk current events. Over the weekend, Turkey erupts and further destabilizes an already destabilized region. Your thoughts on that as you sat and watched it in your home over the weekend?
Yeah, my first thoughts when I heard it on Friday night, there was a coup attempted in Turkey, was wow. I just couldn't believe it. Turkey has a professional military, and I was really surprised to hear that happened. It's definitely going to make things more challenging. You know, with Turkey being a NATO ally, we use their bases to support a lot of operations there. So it's going to be a challenge to see what comes next. And I think the biggest thing right now is there's a lot of uncertainty that we have to undo, overcome before we can move forward. But we'll figure it out and get things going again.
Ron, in your capacity, when you worked, you were what, deputy MAR-4 CENTCOM, in that capacity, did you ever get to Turkey? What's the Marine stake in Turkey?
Well, I think probably UCOM has one of the biggest things. Turkey is right on the border. I had more dealings with Turkey when I was in UCOM because we were planning the support plans for OIF, and we're going to bring in forces through the north, and we're also going to bring in supply lines. There's going to be greatly reduced supply lines coming from two different directions. So we thought it was a slam dunk. We knew we had to do political negotiations, and in our dealings with the Turkish military, actually I had a Turkish brigadier general was a liaison officer to the joint planning group when I was at UCOM. They assured us, this is a process we have to go through, but in the end, you're going to get what you want, and it never happened. We built roads, we built dams, we did things, but the political situation, it was such that it wasn't happening. So we had to, like anything, the military was able to turn that to figure out how to make the best of a bad situation. You know, we used that just to tie up provisions cause the Iraq government to think about something coming from the north, that this is something that could happen. And eventually we ended up using stuff in the north and then in the Kurdish autonomous zone to carry out the mission. So even though there's setbacks, there's always ways around things. You just have to figure out that it's not as easy as you thought, but you can make the best of a bad situation.
Are you at all concerned that this moves Turkey more towards President Erdogan's, it seems like his vision is that Turkey moves away from its secular tradition and more towards that of a Islamic nation. Should Americans be concerned about that? I mean, were you the Secretary of Defense? Would you be concerned about that today?
Well, I'm sure that's something that the Secretary of Defense may be concerned about, but I think we also have to understand from Turkey's perspective what their concerns are with the situation in Iraq and in that area with the Kurds. You know, they have a large portion of their country, especially in the southeast, that have Kurdish origins. And so any autonomy for Kurds in Iraq or in Syria affects them as well, because then there's a push for autonomy and giving up part of their sovereignty for what's now is Turkey. So I think we should really look at it from not just how they're doing this, but you know, what are some of the things that Turkey is concerned about? What's causing them grief and concerns with the situation in the Middle East? And I think the Kurds are one of the key things that they're concerned about.
Well, and what's ironic about the Kurds is if you ask most Americans about the Kurds, they will say, you know what, why don't we just give the Kurds their own, you know, track of land? They seem to be the most competent there. They seem to be the strongest ally there. And yet, you know what I mean? It's like, how do we get out of this thing? It's like this self-licking ice cream cone that we can't get away from, you know? The Kurds are. They're the most stable, you know, they're the best partner in Iraq, and yet when we go down that road, the Turks are just sitting there strumming their fingers on the table, looking at us, going, "What are you doing?"
Yeah, well, I think that's where I come back to what I said. Understanding it from Turkey's perspective, what are their concerns? And their concerns is whatever happens to the Kurds in other parts of the region will happen to Kurds and Turkey, and that they don't want to give up part of their country, just like we wouldn't want California to succeed. We want to build the economy and the power and the unity that we have. We didn't let the South succeed during the Civil War. It's probably the same situation, of course, to Turkey.
Interesting. And it looks like, I mean, I think I saw the report I saw over the weekend said he's arrested 6,000 members of the military. He's charged 150 or so of them so far, and that this will allow him to. Turkey's military has been historically independent of the government, and what it sees itself as part of what guarantees a free and independent and a secular Turkey, and has intervened in the government, I want to say, three times since 1960, and they will he will undoubtedly tighten his own rule on his own hand on that, and it'll be interesting to see what the Turkish military happens to it. Did you get any sense? Have you ever had any deep conversations with Turkish military officers about their role in history in our country?
Well, I think that if you look at Turkey has the same independence as a country and the formation and the modernization with Ataturk. And you can see that there is some pride in that they do look at the secular state is probably the most important principle they have, although they are Islamic, they pride themselves in secularism. There are some, you know, strong forces in there. If you look at the Prophet Muhammad, they have some of the relics, some of the most important relics that belong to Muhammad are in the Blue Mosque in Istanbul, and there's thousands of years of history. So I think that there are lots of things playing that for many, many years on the society. But I think that they have enough taste of modernism and secular that I think that they'll continue to remain moderate, just that we're in a point of, just like in 1960 and the other 1980, when they had hiccups and challenges, this is another one of those bumps. And they'll either make it through or not. But I think more likely, economically, they want to join the EU. I think other factors other than military alone is going to influence this as well, and will have a greater influence than it has in the past.
Want to ask you one more current events question. In the last 10 days, the events that have happened both in Dallas and now in Baton Rouge, Ron, Marines involved in either being victims or perpetrators in at both places, it seems like the country more than ever needs good leadership, and I'm not sure what... I think we struggle with that leadership at these points. Any thoughts on what we've seen in the last 10 days in the country?
Well, I think it is bad. I think it's. I think you're right. We need strong leadership. I think leadership, local leadership, is important. You see good examples of strong leadership in Dallas with the police chief. We need to talk of balance, putting things in perspective. You can't, it's very sad, and I think it's tragic when individual loss of life, taking lives of others does not fix any of the problems. It only makes things worse. And I think there needs to be a voice of reason and an understanding. Also, any complex problem, if you attribute the complex problem to one thing, you're probably overlooking a few other things. For example, I do think there is racism still, and it may be a little bit more hidden than it is, but there may be that racism may be a factor. It's just one factor involved in why individuals are shot by police when they're being arrested. So I think taking a look at the big picture and how do we fix not just one symptom, but how do we address all of the factors and for most of the factors, that's the way we're going to have a long-term and lasting solution. I don't think that we're back to the 60s and where we had race riots and Detroit and massive burning. I think the fact that we are talking about it, there's enough people outraged on both sides about whether it's a black life being taken or a white police lives or police lives taken. The fact that we're talking about it is what's going to hopefully is going to cause a longer term solution based on all of the factors instead of just one or two factors that are the ready answer or the ready thing to blame.
Retired General Ron Baskowski, our guest this morning. And, Ron, how old are you?
Well, I'm in the upper half of my 50s. I'm 58.
All right, so you and I are the same age. And I remember, I was talking when I first came on the program this morning, I remember I was 10 years old in 1968. I remember Martin Luther King getting assassinated, and then Bobby Kennedy 2 months later, less than 2 months later, getting assassinated, and thinking, what the hell is going on? And then you had all the on TV all the time. You'd see the video from Vietnam and the protests. And I just remember thinking, what is going on in our country? And I won't lie to you. I had similar thoughts over the weekend in that. But my question about this concerns leadership in that where are the grown-ups? And I think I was talking about this last week on the show. Whenever you go to work, I think there's certain people that in the Marine Corps, there's certain people that are grown-ups. They're problem solvers. They don't react emotionally. They don't amplify a bad current. I kind of call them, they're insulators and problem solving. So they keep the temperature down, they solve problems, and they're the people that you go to when you have a problem. The nation is looking for the adults in the room, the insulators and the problem solvers. And looking around, it's who's going to dial this down? And then I agree with you, the police chief in Dallas, what a man. in terms of being under incredible stress, the anger that he must feel of having his police officers gunned down, and yet stayed composed throughout the whole thing, looked for broader solutions, you know, and didn't say probably what was, you know, some of the things that were really in his heart, but the anger that he felt about the murder of five police officers in Dallas. And it's just, I don't know, I look around the country, and I would tell you this, this is a show devoted to the culture of the Marine Corps. The message that I would tell Marines that are listening, on active duty, former Marines, whoever, it's time for us to be more involved in the country, because the country needs us. One of the comments I get from civilians who listen to this program is, you know what, we don't get to hear your voices often enough. We see you guys doing a bunch of stuff, but I love the way you guys don't mince words. You guys, if you have an opinion, you say it, and then you'll argue about it. But you guys tend not to, like, dance around the fire too much. You guys say what you feel, and it's certainly refreshing, and we need more Marines. So, I don't know, Ryan. To me, if there's a message in trying times, the country needs more Marines, more soldiers, more sailors, more airmen to get involved, because we live in a colorless society. We don't give a crap what color you are. We don't care what religion you are. All we care is if you could do the work and you're up to it. And so I think that our voices need to become part of this, more of a part of this, and all over the country we need to be more involved. And so I don't know. I'm looking for a solution. And what I see on TV doesn't give me a whole lot of hope. So I always believe more Marines involved in something's a good thing.
Well, I don't disagree. I think that I do think that the military culture is a great culture. Here's a place where you can disagree and you can give your advice to a boss that may be entirely different than what you know he wants to hear. And he may listen to your advice and then say, yeah, I hear it, but do it anyways, because this is what we're going to do for this reason, and then everybody steps out and executes as if the plan was their own. So I think the culture that you're talking about is how do you live with differences? How do you disagree but still carry on to accomplish the mission and have overall goal? I think that's one of the things that people don't understand about the military is we do give up. You know, the rights of the individual are not preeminent. The rights of what's best for everyone, which is not really what a founding principle of our country is. You know, it's the rights of the individual or rights of the minority are the founding principle. So there is a difference between the military culture and the American culture. And I think that's one of the fundamental differences. And I think that there's going to have to be some changes, compromises in order to, if we're going to all live together, these things, the differences, and we're so close together now, that we're going to have to learn how to live with differences in a amicable manner. You can't have, oh, if I don't get what I want, I'm going to commit mass murder, or it's my way or the highway. It can't be that way. There has to be compromise. And I think we're seeing more and more that compromise is a thing of the past.
Right. But we all know it's the only way of the future. And what's interesting, what you said about the cultural differences between the Marine Corps or the military and normal, regular society, one of the things we all learn, though, is we all learn so much about other cultures and that we had no idea about growing up wherever we grew up. And you come away such a richer person in terms of an appreciation for, you know what, no different than me. Here I thought all this whole time that Hispanic people, you know, I didn't know them, you know, I didn't understand them. They're the same as my family because I know this because now I got a bunch of Hispanic friends. And they're, you know, but I didn't grow up around them. So, you know, I was largely ignorant. And so the military forced me to be able to come to grips with that it wasn't going to be my way. It was our way. And that way included everybody. And so, having to approach the issue like that, it made me such a better person. But, you know, how do we get there? How do we get there in regular society when everybody seems to show up with a chip on their shoulder? You know, for instance, this morning, if you're a cop, how do you not go out reaching for your pistol quicker? Or how do you not now, when you go to a call, grab your long rifle instead of just taking your pistol?
I mean, you'd have to be stupid not to look around at the events of the last 10 days and say, you know what, I'm not going out like that. And so it's just a difficult week, and it's going to get even more difficult. Breaking news right now, Baltimore Police Lieutenant Brian Rice has been found not guilty on all charges tied to the death of Freddie Gray. So you're not far from Baltimore. That's been a huge story there, and so we'll live through another piece of it today. Anyway.
Well, I think that we've seen a progression. When Freddie Gray when that event first happened, it was violence and there was rioting. But I think three other officers have been acquitted of criminal charges. In the case so far, and this is just the last of the cases. I think that Baltimore has done a much better job explaining and taking precautions, taking events, and being proactive as time has gone. So I think there's even greater education that's required. For example, what's the difference between criminal and administrative proceedings? Somebody may have not followed administrative proceedings, but is it criminal in nature or is it administrative? There's still a lot of administration sort of matters that can or will be taken if individuals hadn't followed policy or rules and regulations. But it doesn't raise to the level of criminal action. And I think that's the big thing, is people understand the difference between criminal and administrative, and failing to follow policy and procedures versus willful harm, causing willful harm. So I think as we become more educated, you can't just convict somebody because it's unpopular what they did, or because
something bad happened.
Something bad happened.
Yeah, but it, you know, you make it. That's a great point. In turn, but you know what? That's not going to be the way the nation sees the headline on CNN, and that is what they'll see is, oh well, he's innocent. And what you're saying is, no, he may not be innocent. He may have failed to follow the procedures in terms of, you know, he's supposed to be strapped in a seat, blah, 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 blah. Doesn't mean he's innocent. It means he's not criminally. There is enough evidence to criminally indict him. But that's the problem, you know, the problem is, you know, and again, the more I watch this, and I've done talk radio now for going on, you know, 10 or 11 years, and CNN, the news networks, what does this mean to them? Big ratings, which means big revenue. And so, so to me, they're guilty of trying to keep the ball up in the air. And the way I write this headline, you know, it could have had a comma, you know, police disciplinary action still pending. And it would convey that, hey, this isn't over yet. He's just not criminally guilty, which is the complete thought. But that doesn't sell. And so, I don't know. I'm not feeling good about the democracy today. It's watching it over the last 10 days, Ron. It's just, man, 8 families, right, without a father now, and cops getting gunned down. And look, I wish you and I could sit here this morning and say, yeah, we're beyond that. With the number of crazy people, and it looks by all accounts that, you know, a former Marine did this. You read the stuff that he said and what he was doing, what he's publishing. It looked like he clearly had, you know, mental health issues. And then the guy in Dallas, I mean, there was organizations, black organizations that had labeled him, hey, this guy's a nut. And so you have this overheated rhetoric, and you have people with mental health issues, and they click off safe. And again, both these guys are veterans. The veteran piece of this, you know, and the guy in Dallas, he was a carpenter and a masonry guy. So, I mean, he was a construction guy in the Army, reserve, and he killed 5 cops. The Marine, he was a data guy and killed 3 cops. God forbid the guys who are grunts get a weapon and get pissed and go after people. What will happen then? So, I don't know. It's just, I'm not in a good place relative to the democracy. So I'll keep my fingers crossed, and maybe we should change subject.
Okay. I think if you hit on one big thing, you hit on it, it goes back to it. It's not one factor. It's not the fact that these were veterans and that they that caused them to do it. It's not the fact that there's a lot of factors involved, to include mental illness, to include the media highlighting certain aspects of crime that trigger things. So I think until we look at the whole picture, I think we're going to, it's always going to look a goony. But if we look at the bigger picture, we can maybe find solutions to some very tough problems.
All right. Mike McNamara, Ron Baskowski, Solving the Nation's Social Ills this morning. And not doing, at least on my part, Ron much more articulate than me, but I'm just pissed, so we'll change subjects. And Ron, can you, we have to take a quick break. Can you hold on for a couple minutes as we do that? Anyway, my guest this morning, former Marine Brigadier General Ron Baskowski. And he and I crossed paths at the basic school. He built the first terrain model I'd ever seen. And he just back from Lebanon as a first lieutenant. I was a second lieutenant going through the course. And we were doing squad in the attack. Yeah, out there by, I think it was MA6. Anyway, we'll continue with that. More Bomberman Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts with 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light, put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, BattleMug.com.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOC community should be aware of.
The Global SOC Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsocfoundation.org
/Marine.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Minutes up at 8 here on a Monday morning. Mike McNamara with you. All Marine Radio continues. Graciously hanging with us is Brigadier General Ron Babkowski, retired. And Ron, first of all, let's find out about you now that we're done with the social commentary portion of the program.
Okay.
Born and raised where?
I grew up in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, a small town just outside of New Bedford.
All right. So how does the Marine Corps... you're a naval academy guy, right?
I sure am. I was growing up in New Bedford area. It's on the ocean. It's got a great maritime history and maritime tradition. I got very interested in going into a maritime career, either merchant marine or Coast Guard or the Navy. I had a blue and gold officer. Those were one of the liaison officers right. of the naval academy. Living in the same town, and he took me on a trip to the Naval Academy and driven around. I learned about the academics. I learned about all the facilities and the opportunities, and I just fell in love with the place. So I was accepted there at the last minute, in fact, 4 days before the class started, and my life has just been one adventure after that. It was probably the greatest thing that ever could happen to me. Not only did I get a great education, but I learned and met thousands of people. I had experiences. I traveled the world, and I couldn't be more pleased with what happened. It was probably the best thing that ever happened to me in my whole life.
Wow. So the maritime tradition of the place where you grew up. No Marines in your family?
No. I have seven brothers and sisters, or six brothers and sisters. I was the second oldest. My family came from the Midwest. They moved gradually to the coast. No military service. My father had been, did a tour in the Army around Korea, but didn't do combat tour. I think he was kind of skeptical of me going into the military. He saw the great opportunity that the Naval Academy provided and that great education and all the things it provided after him. He helped me, he encouraged me to pursue it.
So you go to the Naval Academy, and how does the Marine Corps get on your, so you come from this great maritime tradition, the seagoing tradition, on the coast of Massachusetts. How does the Marine Corps get on your horizon?
Well, I love going to sea. I love going on a ship. I enjoy that, and like I saw, but at the Naval Academy, 16 2/3% of the class could go into the Marine Corps. And they had Marines on the staff, and I played hockey, and rep for the hockey team was a Marine, Major Kennedy, Major Paul Kennedy, or Kevin Kennedy. And, every Marine that I had that was an instructor, General Stanley was my leadership instructor when I was a he was a captain at that time. Every Marine that I saw at the Naval Academy was just awesome. They really impressed you and impressed me, and they were involved and engaged with the students, and they were just impressive. And as I continued there and I turned to the options, I could see that I could have the best of both worlds. I really love the outdoors. I've always liked rock climbing, hiking, Appalachian Trail, and things like that. But I also like to go in the sea. So being a Marine could have the best of both worlds. So the influence and professionalism of the Marines at the Naval Academy really got me interested. And then when I did the summer cruise where you go around and you do all the different services.
Right.
My time at Quantico was just fantastic, and I became more convinced than ever that the Marine Corps is what I wanted to do.
You know, it's really interesting, now that I interview Marines on a daily basis, the Marines that had no contact with the Marine Corps, be it through family or didn't grow up around Marines, the one thing, it's like they universally say, I saw these Marines, the way they looked in their uniform, the way they conducted themselves, I said, who are those guys? I want to be part of that because they were so different. So it's really interesting. The stuff that we emphasize as a culture is such a huge draw for guys who ultimately join the Marine Corps. Simply what they see visually and then the way they see them conduct themselves professionally makes a huge dent and sends them through the door saying, hey, what is this organization? And might I be a part of it? So it's really interesting in terms of the way we conduct ourselves. Go ahead. So now you get to the basic school. How did you find yourself to the infantry field?
Well, I like the outdoors. That rock climbing thing. Rock climbing, kayaking, hiking, everything. I love that. I thought I wanted to be an engineer, but there was only one engineer spot. I was a mechanical engineer at the Naval Academy. There was only one engineer spot. Yeah, I didn't think that I'll never get that. So I chose infantry as my number one choice. And fortunately, I got that because I think I would have liked being an engineer, but I don't think I would have had the same opportunities as an engineer as I have had as an infantry officer.
You know, I don't think it's close. In fact, I interviewed somebody and said, you know, they didn't tell me that there was only, I can't remember how many slots he said for engineers at whatever level. He said, that career path dries up pretty quick. I said, well, should have been a grunt. We run the show. And he laughed. He said, you know what? I should have been a grunt. But the, so now you graduated from basic school and you head where?
From there, I went to IOC, of course, and then Ranger School. I really wanted the confidence that Ranger School would give me. So I was one of three officers from my basic school class that got to go to the Ranger course. It was fantastic. It was three phases. It really helped my confidence. It helped me work under pressure a lot better. And I understood things a lot better. So it was another great experience. I'm glad it was over, but I was glad I did it. And I think it set me up for success in everything from the way to think, the five paragraph order. I did everything in five paragraph order format. That's how you would get tired. If you just follow that as a guideline and you can really and make sure you're not leaving out anything. You're not making mistakes. You're not overlooking anything. And it's just a framework that helps you think. It doesn't make you think a certain way. It just helps you think and make sure that you're operating efficiently while under stress or while you have a whole lot of things going on. So I thought that was a great experience, and it gave me the confidence. I'll be honest with you. This is open kimono. I don't know if you have my picture up, but I was probably the youngest looking lieutenant. I looked like I was in high school still. I had a lot of confidence issues that I had to overcome because I knew that I didn't like looking like the brand new lieutenant, and I looked so young that I knew that I needed all the confidence I can get, and I needed to be good. in order to gain the confidence in my Lorraine's bed. So I wanted to delay it for at least until I was 23.
You know, I mean, it's interesting you bring that up, Ron, because that's not a small issue. I mean, I think that most, when you're, it's interesting, the path to become an officer, and in our case, infantry officers in the Fleet Marine Force, a lot of, in fact, our fellow branches of the service, you know, you go to officer candidate school, and then you go to your MOS school, and boom, you're in front of somebody. And that might be 3 months of officer candidate school, 2 months of an MOS school. And so within 5 months, you're in front of somebody, in theory. In the Marine Corps, you throw the basic school on top of that, and then the infantry officer course is 13 weeks now, so I mean it's the better part of 3 months. So you don't stand in front of anybody in the Marine Corps until you've probably been in the Marine Corps on active duty for about a year, and I think that's a huge investment in our enlisted Marines, and because we put out a higher quality product, and yet even after a year, you know. And here's a guy from the Naval Academy saying, I had, you know, self-confidence issues, and I wanted to be better prepared to do that. And those are not small things relative to leading. Confidence is probably the biggest factor in leadership above all.
No, I agree. The best thing you can do is train somebody. If you train them, it gives them confidence. If you give them confidence, they're more likely to act. And I think it's the reverse, but the less you know, the more likely you are not to act,
right.
Because you don't want to show anybody what you don't know.
Yeah, nobody wants to show their ass in public, so it's like, what? But if you think you have a clue, and I will tell you this, I don't think there's any organization that educates and trains young leaders better than the Marine Corps. And I will tell you specifically, infantry officers, we have the best corps, the things that we've done in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the dispersed nature that fight has existed over, where you have lieutenants and staff sergeants running cities and villages and dealing with all kinds of issues beyond the scope of their company commander on a daily basis, is a tribute, really, to the way we our training has evolved and the quality of the training that Marine officers go through. And I'm not just beating my Marine Corps chest this morning. I think that's a fact, and Ron, you've seen it in everywhere you've gone in your military career.
Well, I agree. I definitely agree with your comments on training and what we make lieutenants ask lieutenants to do now and captains. We're asking them to do what was done at a much higher level, at the regiment or battalion at least, but oftentimes the size of their sectors and areas of responsibility, the size of regimental areas of responsibility from the past. So, yes, we have a great deal of them, and they're doing, for the most part, a great job.
Let's talk about you going to the fleet. So you go to 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, and were you fired up to go there?
Oh, absolutely. I asked for 1-8. In fact, not only did I ask for infantry, I asked for duty station, and 8th Marines is where I wanted to go. And the reason for that is at that time, deployment. It didn't have use. It was MILES, Marine Amphibious Units.
Right.
The ones on the East Coast were the BLTs, the battalion landing teams, were from the 8th Marines and one battalion from the 6th Marines. And then on the West Coast, it was the West Pass were run out of Camp Pendleton. So those were the two places to go, Camp Lejeune and Pendleton, to be with a Marine Amphibious Unit. I was fortunate to get 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, which was great. The first time deployment I made after I joined, it was probably the ideal. I call it the love boat cruise. We made med deployment. We left Camp Lejeune on in January. It was the day that the day after the airplane crash into the 14th Street Bridge in Washington D.C. It was miserable. On the East Coast. But we got underway. We went down to Puerto Rico and did a naval gunfire exercise in Vegas. And then we pulled Liberty in the Virgin Islands. It was like just unbelievable. It's a lot, lot of land. Then we went in and we did an entrapment to the med and we did an exercise in Galicia, Spain. Then we pulled Liberty in Barcelona and then we did an exercise in Capitola, Colada, Sardinia. Then we did a a landing in Egypt on around Easter time, and then get through the Suez Canal. So we did it in Egypt as a demonstration to show, you know, amphibious landing.
Right.
Then we went through the Suez Canal, and we did a crossing line, and we did an exercise in Kenya. And then we came back up through, we got to Palma and Barcelona and exercising in between in Mombasa, Kenya. We had Liberty. We did Liberty in Israel, which was significant because we had to leave the port one day early because the commercial ships with the region were coming into the port and they needed the berth that we were at. But in reality, the Israelis had asked us to leave because the next day, after we were out to sea, they went up and start up in Lebanon and they started Operation Peaceful Galilee. We did more training in Capitolata, another exercise in Capitolata, and then we did training in Toulon, France for 2 weeks while the ships did maintenance. It was all around. It was like the dream cruise. It's what people joined the
it's
for.
It's why the rest of us hated you guys.
Yeah,
if you were, I'll tell you what, if you were in an 8th Marine and you were doing nothing, 8th Marines doing everything, everybody else sitting there watching them. And if you were on the West Coast, there was nothing going on the West Coast. You were going to Okinawa, and 8th Marines out there living the life, man. You talked to, you crossed paths with your friends who went to 8th Marines, and they'd start telling you these kind of stories. And it, did you just listen to the kind of Liberty Port she's talking about? It was disgusting. And then, so you do that, and then you come back to Camp Lejeune. How does that whole thing end up?
Well, after that, we did a really quick turnaround. We got back from the Love Boat deployment in June of 1982, and we deployed again in May of 1983. So in less than a year, we were underway again, but this time we were on our way for a different mission. I'll say the turnaround time that we had between deployments was really quick. So, especially when you consider that when we got back from deployment, we went on, our battalion was assigned to 4 months of mess guard and police and air alert. Nowadays, I think the Marine Corps does a much better job, and we're doing that much smarter. You know, where we now have most of civilianized mess halls, chow halls, we used to put Marines, take them out for training and battle line for 3 months at a time, and a battalion out of training for 4 months so that they could stand guard, or so that a company would have mess duty for a month, and it would be police and guard duty for a month at a time. So you couldn't do anything. So if you only have 11 months prepared for deployment, 4 of those months you're spending doing non-value-added activity. We didn't have a whole lot of time to prepare for our mission. But in the meantime, after, you know, I mentioned that when we were in Israel on the first deployment, they invaded into Lebanon and they drove the PLO up into Beirut. The battalion that had, or the mile that had relieved us actually ended up going in and they did the withdrawal of the Palestinian Liberation Organization out of Beirut. Because it was a huge standoff with the Israeli Defense Force, getting ready to go in and fight in a very brutal hand-to-hand type environment, mount environment, and it's no good it's going to come out of that. So, we were able, the Marine Corps, or the Navy, went in and with the Marines orchestrated the withdrawal of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And all of their families stayed behind in refugee camps, two primarily in Sabra and Sakila. After that happened, the Mao brought the Marines back onto shipping and we are now at sea. Well, a short time after that, a Christian militia entered into refugee camps in Sabra and Sakila and they massacred families. And it was perceived that, you know, this was the Christian phalange massacring civilians that we put into this situation, and the Israeli Defense Force stood by and let it happen. So out of guilt, the multinational force returned to Lebanon and took up a peacekeeping mission with 3rd Battalion 8th Marines going during the first round. They occupied ground first. 2/6, another battalion that relieved 3/8, took over, and then we took over from 2/6. So we had a Love Boat first deployment, and we had a anything but normal second deployment to the Navy. Right into Lebanon, took over from T-6, took over their positions, and assumed the Peacekeeper mission.
You know, Ron, you walking us through those events, the evacuation of the PLO. You know, you say PLO, you know, most young people are like, what? What is that? I've never heard of the PLO. Well, you're alive in the 80s, you would have heard of the PLO. It was the primary, I don't know, we would call them terrorist group at the time, or... But they were the fighters that represented the Palestinians, led by Yasser Arafat, who was kind of the face of, I don't know, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. So he was the face of the Palestinians and their cause in the Middle East, in particular vis-a-vis Israel. The perception. I want to walk back. So the evacuation of the PLO, that's our first kind of foray into Lebanon, yes? Military.
Well, not really. In the 80s,
yes.
Right. You know, we had gone off in Lebanon in the 50s, it was 58. But, yeah, in recent times, that was the first.
So we essentially do an evacuation. We provide security, the Navy provides the shipping, and we remove the PLO from Lebanon. Then the incidents in those two refugee camps, and that causes major, major problems in the region and really kind of sets up, the tension in the region, which ultimately requires, quote unquote, peacekeepers to come back, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. Those were major events. Another major event was the assassination of Pierre Gemayel by he was either the president or he was the president-elect, and he was massacred. He was assassinated shortly before Sabra and Shatila. It was a powder keg that just kept on getting embers closer and closer to it until it finally blew up.
Right. And so into that, and can you give me the time frame when you said 3-8 was the first mile to go in there? What was the time frame that 3-8 went in?
Yeah, I think it was probably around fall our time. It was late fall. It might have been October, and I think they were in through the new year.
Of 82 into 83?
Into 83.
Okay.
And then 2-6 was in there in between, and then we took over in about the June time frame. By the time we sailed over there and took over, it was about the beginning of June in 83.
My guest, Brigadier General retired Ron Baskowski. He was born and raised in Massachusetts through the Naval Academy, infantry officer. We're talking about Beirut and the Marines' involvement in Beirut, Lebanon, in the 1980s. Ron, so as you looked at the mission, as you guys prepared, knowing where you were going, what were your thoughts about the mission, what you guys were going to be asked to do?
Well, first, you know, it was kind of a surprise. I think we had not a whole lot. We did the planning for our deployment well before we knew that we were going to be doing the peacekeeping mission. So we planned for amphibious training. We went to training at LSDC Atlantic. They did an amphibious practice for each company. One of the new things that we did practice was a non-evacuation non-combatant evacuation operations in NEO. And so we were planning a conventional deployment, but with potential missions that might happen, not knowing we were going to go during a peacekeeping. Then we found out that we were going to do peacekeeping missions. We were going to take over from 2-6. We started doing plans for that as well. We started doing a lot of professional military education on what's going on in Lebanon, who the factions are. We tried to understand as much about what was going on. We talked to the commander from 3-8, who had just returned Black Jack Matthews, Colonel Black Jack Matthews, who told us to, they gave us an insight and told TMEs or officers. We started doing a lot of what-if scenarios on rules of engagement and things like that. But we already had less than a usual amount of time to train before deployment. We didn't have any specific peacekeeping training. We didn't talk about principles of peacekeeping and neutrality and things like that. We just knew that we were supposed to go in there and establish a presence, provide security, add a stabilizing effect to the environment. The one thing I would say, though, that gave us a great advantage as a company, I was the Alpha Company 1-8. Our CEO was a guy named Captain Paul Roy. All the company commanders that were with the battalion had just graduated from AWS. They all knew each other, and they had relationships already. Paul Roy had a buddy that worked at Division Schools, and somehow he was able to get us 40 quotas for corporals and lance corporals, because most of our squad leaders were senior ones with corporals, and he had lance corporals as squad leaders.
Right.
But he got them into Division Schools to do the formal squad leaders course, which gave us a huge advantage, which really paid off as we started working at different sectors and in different areas, and were highly dispersed around the airfield. But I think the bottom line is we didn't have a lot of time to train, and I don't think that we actually focused in on peacekeeping per se. We had a conventional military force mindset going into Lebanon.
And when you guys go to Lebanon, what billet does it hold on?
Well, I was the XO for Alpha Company 1-8, but an interesting thing was because Lebanon was not just the U.S., it was a multinational force. We had the French at the very north. We had the Italians in the center around Sabra and Shatila. We had the Brits along the Green Line out by the Lebanese Scientific University. It took all of the XOs from the rifle companies and they made us their ground officers. So about a day and a half or 2 days out from Rota, we were on the LSP. We had causeways on the side, so we couldn't land a helicopter on an already small flight deck. They lowered me into a boat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and put me over to the El Paso, which was the LKA. And there I got on a 56 and a 53, and they flew to Larnaca, and then from Larnaca, they put the XOs in early, and we linked up with the liaison officers from T6, and learned what we were supposed to do. I got the good straw, or pulled the light straw. I got to link up with the French. I was the French liaison officer to the 31st Brigade, the 12th Brigade. They were regular army, but they had French Foreign Legion with them, and then they also had a cavalry unit with them. And they had, like I said, they were in the northern part, so it was right in the city proper of Beirut. Their headquarters was up at the governor's mansion. France had a huge influence on Lebanon.
Right.
In fact, a lot of French-speaking, Lebanon was one of the major languages that was spoken in Beirut. And lived up in a place called the Hippodrome. It's a horse racetrack, and the government managed. And I lived in a tent out there on the roof. My radio operator was on the next roof up. We hired, so we had good radio communication with the PLP. And every morning we got up with the French, and we did their PT with them. They put guards along the horse track. We ran the horse track, and we PT'd with them. And then I would spend the day going around to different positions, talking to the different commanders and the soldiers, try to get an understanding of their area of responsibility. The French had a great intel network, and I would hook up their they call it B2, that's their S2. I would coordinate meetings with him and the MAO-S2 and the BOTS2 to exchange intelligence. We also got to set up cross training for wildfire shoots between Marines and the French and Marines from the LAF and the French. And it was a great time. The French really were, I thought the Foreign Legion reminded me of Marines. They had the same kind of traditions and esprit and things like that. They, And everybody has a fascination with weapons. They had the Hamas. They're really proud of their Hamas. We were really proud of our weapon systems that we would do if we were to go up to the Chouf Mountains. If there was a range up there, and we would shoot. We'd take Lebanese armed forces with us, and we would shoot and train with them and exchange, do weapons exchange with each other. It was fantastic.
My guest this morning, Ron Vaskowski, Brigadier General, retired United States Marine Corps. We're talking about his time in Beirut. And, Ron, let me ask you, did you, so you guys go in there, and essentially you're a peacekeeping piece, and you're embedded with the French as a liaison officer. Did you notice the tension, and did the tension change when, I believe it was it the New Jersey that was shooting off the coast, when they started shooting in support of the Lebanese army? Did you notice, because a lot of people will point to that, and the deadly fire from the United States, if you can imagine, a United States Navy battleship out there booming off the coast. Was there anything that you guys detected in terms of, hey, something's wrong here?
Yeah, there definitely was a shift. One of the things that the French had a totally different concept of deployment, because of their experience in Algiers and because of the city, their concept of deployment was to more of a traditional counterinsurgency type deployments. They would have squads out and living in buildings with families. They lived among the populace. They lived throughout the city. So you could really see that. You could see it clearly, that they had a different concept, where the U.S., we had a centralized location down at the airport, and we would patrol out from there. The French lived, and they patrolled between posts, and so they were, I think, in greater tune with the populace. But the populace in the northern part of the city, especially on the east, they told the French what they wanted to hear, I think, as well. But what we started noticing was, there was an increase of direct fire and then indirect fire. We noticed that so much so that towards the end of August and in September, we started getting indirect fire, and Lieutenant George Rossi and Sachin Ortega of Alpha Company were hit by, killed by mortar fire. So now I've been the XO for Alpha Company, and that's only lost. Kind of low, so they're down two officers, so I returned to the airport. And you could, at different points in the airport, you could see what was going on. Like you could, from the center sector where we were, where Alpha Company was, when I went back, you could look up into the Chouf Mountains and you could see valleys that ran east to west, and we could see the artillery shooting. We were just itching to shoot back. In fact, we cheered when we heard naval gunfire going off. We were just itching to shoot with our mortars and artillery. The response is, who wants to be shot at and be sitting ducks down there on the low ground? Nobody. So it was a huge boost for morale when we started shooting. But again, that goes back to what I said about the principles of peacekeeping. We had no idea of how this would be perceived as being neutral or not being neutral. We were part of the enemy now.
And that kind of happens, and it really goes unnoticed by us. Let me ask you, I had Phil Smith on last week, and he said when he got there with 2-8, one of the first things that struck him was the proximity of the Chouf Mountains to the airport. He said, they're right on top of you. And he said, I don't know why it didn't, hit me in the head sooner. But when we showed up off the coast of Beirut, and then he said we did an amphibious landing, when we got there, you look up and the Chouf Mountains just dominate the airport. He said it was pretty daunting. It was pretty daunting to be there.
No, that's correct. I agree. They were right there. It's like California. You come in just off of the shore, and there are the mountains right backing up. And you could see up into the chute at different points. You couldn't see the Bekaa Valley, Right. We'd hear in Pecan Valley, and we knew all sorts of stuff was going on out there.
3 kilometers is the distance between probably the center of the airport and the mountains of the Chute Mountain. I mean, you realize, if you kind of look at the map and you're like, oh, wow, that's pretty close. Then you measure it in 3 clicks. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. I mean, it's even closer at the southern end of the airport. Because the mountains closed down right to the coast.
Yeah.
And we're in 50-cal range.
Yeah, it's like 2 clicks at the southern end. Like, you got to be kidding me. I've got Google Earth out. It's just, when he said that, I got on Google Earth and it's like barely 2 clicks at the southern end. Holy smokes. And I think, you know, as we look back on Lebanon, you know, until you revisit it, you know, and then you guys are in the midst of all of that. And then all of a sudden, as you guys begin to defend yourself, you guys, unbeknownst to you, the Thai kind of opinion about us as peacekeepers changes, correct?
That's correct.
All right. Talk to us about so much was made in the aftermath of the barracks bombing, of the rules of engagement there. It, you know, we've all learned that, you know, it's just something we live with, rules of engagement. Talk to us about the rules of engagement. Did you guys roll around with magazines and weapons? Were you trying to be peacekeepers in this violent? I mean, you're taking Marines killed in action, right? And how did you guys roll around on a daily basis, and what were the rules of engagement?
Well, we did a lot of drilling on the rules of engagement and weapons conditions. We did a lot of things like that. But I think the rules of engagement were confusing because I think the reason why the rules of engagement were confusing is because you had 2 sets, one when you're under fire and one when you're not under fire, and you had two different cards. You had a white card, I think, and a blue card, and so we were complicating things because we were trying to be so specific. But I think the weapons condition were not a result of the rules of engagement. I think there's a lot of criticism about, you know, when you're on the interior guard position, you had magazines in the weapon, but no round in the chamber. Crucifix weapons were not loaded. I think that weapons condition was internal policy for interior guard because we were having, and this was a function of training,
right,
we were having a large number of negligent discharges. And some of the biggest violators, I think, were, you know, officers and staff NCOs with the 45s. Why do I say that? At that time, we never took our pistols to the field. And we didn't routinely use our pistols, and the 45 was so different than other weapons. But I do think Marines were not as familiar with weapons because we didn't have numerous rounds to extend. We would go to the last range and we may go to the field, but this was a time, you know, we were coming off of some austerity at measures, and this is just, you know, just prior to the Reagan era, and Reagan was in, and he was credited with rebuilding or rejuvenating the military. But, you know, it wasn't unusual to go to the field and do a live fire exercise with 10 rounds of ammo. Marines just weren't familiar with the weapons. And talk about compressed time, they didn't have time either. And so there were negligent discharges, and I think one of the causes of the weapons conditions and reasons, it was more dangerous in the DOT headquarters to have a guard with a weapon, with a round in their magazine, or in the chamber, because negligent discharges, rather than anything else. So I think that the two are not directly related. I think there was 2 distinct things going on. One, the rules of engagement were complicated, but interior to the DOT, the weapons conditions were a function of concerns over the being more dangerous to have negligent discharges.
You know, Ron, it's interesting because, you know, at face value, when you hear how weapons are being carried, you think, God, that's crazy. But when there's negligent discharges going on, I mean, you talk about something that gets everybody's attention, Like, are you kidding me? I can recall at Camp Pendleton, officers taking, when we had to take pistols to the field, they would wrap them in plastic so they wouldn't get dirty, so they wouldn't have to clean them. And that's, I mean, I can't imagine that today, but that's the way it was. And as you said, talk about lack of familiarity, if you don't use it, you know, we had, you know, issues with making discharges in Iraq and Afghanistan. Certainly weren't that many of them, but for units, when they first got there, it seemed like everybody had them. And it was, you know, a failure to adhere just to the basics of clearing your weapon. Did you really look? Did you really stick your finger in there? No. Oh, you got in a hurry. And now look where we're at. And so, and that's with the Marine Corps in Iraq and Afghanistan that shot a lot before it went. And a lot of experienced guys. And so, but you still have those issues. So the rules of engagement, explain how rules change between the white and the blue card when you weren't under attack and then when you were.
It was returning, when you could return fire, if you could identify the target, you could return fire. If you couldn't identify the target, you weren't authorized to return fire. So there was quite a lot of nuance, and the detail. It actually took up two whole cards. I don't even remember all of the differences, but I do remember grilling the Marines on it and going over what-if scenarios, which was probably one of the best things that we could do, given the amount of time that we had and given the complexity of the rules of engagement.
Got an email for you. Mac, I'm listening, and Beirut, I look back on it, and I didn't understand it very well. I thought the Marines were there as peacekeepers and kind of doing their job. In reality, it looks like they got stuck into the middle of a shit sandwich. And then as we began to be more aggressive with our naval gunfire, got put in a very, very precarious situation, probably one that we really didn't understand well at the time, given the complexities of that region and our ignorance of those complexities, I would tell you, to include today. I'm curious, though, did Ron think, as a platoon commander, that his guys were well-prepared? Did he think that the rules of engagement put them at a serious disadvantage? So, Ron, at the time, did you think the rules of engagement put you at a serious disadvantage, or was it something like, because I got asked that in Iraq and Afghanistan, hey, you know, the rules of engagement, we hear your hands are tied, and my response was, our hands are tied. If there's Marines in trouble, we can do whatever we need to defend the Marine lives. You know, people that tell you that probably haven't really read the rules of engagement and haven't drilled into them, because if you have and you know them, you have everything in there that you need to do to be able to save Marine lives. So did you feel at the time that you guys, you know, were solid, or did you feel some trepidation relative to the rules of engagement?
Well, you know, we felt frustrated. We felt frustrated. We understood the rules of engagement. We understood what we could and we couldn't do. But we tried to focus more on what we can do rather than what we can't do. But, you know, some of the frustrations that you would experience, it was things like, you know, we were down in the center sector and we had a wall out there and there was a hole in the wall. We called it a hole in the wall gang. And you could see the individual shooting from a hole in the wall, and they would stop shooting and they would walk away. While they were shooting, you could engage, but while they walked away, you couldn't do anything. So not understanding why we had the rules of engagement that we had, it was very frustrating.
Hold on. So even after he's shooting, you positively identify him as a shooter, and then he stops shooting and walks away, you can no longer engage him.
Yeah, that's how we saw it, and that was the way it was, that's the situation we were in.
That's tough. How did your Marines must have been ripped shit about that? They couldn't have been too happy.
No. They were at first, but you start learning how to do things. And I will say, while we were not well trained at the beginning, completely well trained for a lot of different reasons, we really got brilliant in the basics and doing things. And you know, one of the things I think the use of snipers were things that you could do. It's because we wanted precision. We were trying to avoid the hole in the wall was, I'll tell you, the hole in the wall gang was in a place called Hooterville, Bergeron Barajanov. And collateral damage, there was a really high risk of collateral damage of the local civilians in a slum, basically, outside. And we couldn't afford to alienate the population there by killing kids or innocents or non-combatants.
Right.
So I could see, in hindsight, I could see why we had that. But what we did to overcome, we started getting brilliant in the basics. And that's a good example. The classic image of an untrained army is firing a machine gun freehand, a free gun.
Sure.
But using a TNA is much better because once you get locked on a target, when you want to fire, you're locked on and you're going to have power impact. So we would do things like set up machine gun on TNAs. Somebody would start shooting, and we would quickly dispatch them at the time and not have to wait till they walked away and waved at us and contempt. So coming up with things like range cards and being able to communicate and I still remember we had the hole in the wall gang. We had the skeletal building. It was a building that was like a skeleton. We had checkpoints all over the place. We were able to communicate very badly, using landline and radio. We couldn't hit it from one area. We could oftentimes see it from another area and talk people on the target and being locked in on a TNA or using innovation. We were able to adapt and overcome. So I do think that, instead of focusing on what we couldn't do, we learned how to focus on what we could do and really started to have success in quieting things down.
My guest this morning, Brigadier General retired Ron Baskowski. We're talking about his time in Beirut, and he's gracious enough to give up some of his morning here to join us on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. Ron, can you talk about what your snipers were able to do then? If they had different rules of engagement, what were they? So you positively identified somebody at the hole in the wall. Could the snipers continue to engage?
Yeah, but they were in a position. The snipers had the same rules of engagement. It was a hostile act initiated against a U.S. force. But the thing about them is they were more precise and they had a much smaller footprint and we would often put them off the side or in between positions and high positions where they could observe and have a good angle. And then with their range cards, when the hole in the wall started, they could hit targets very precisely and for different targets throughout Hooterville, they could engage. So that was how we used the snipers. They weren't in the same kind of visible position that we were. We were in position that had overhead cover. They were more in sniper hide position.
All right. Talk about the day that the barracks was destroyed. First of all, where was the barracks relative to your position at the airport? So you're in the center part of the airport.
Well, actually, we changed positions. So this is one of the things that, in hindsight, I say how long could I be?
Right. There
was a policy that's rotating the company. So Alpha Company started out at the southern end of the airfield when we first got to Beirut.
Okay.
Just shortly after, they rotated up to the center part of the airfield. That's when Lieutenant Losey got killed. And then after about 2 months there, we rotated out to the Lebanese Scientific University, which was out there by the Green Line. So we took all these positions together. There was like a line that kept that provided like a buffer. So the Israeli Defense Force couldn't come inside a buffer zone that was set up by our position. So we were there to ensure they didn't get inside where the Muslim population was. So at the time we just couldn't understand. We got everything perfect at our position. The battalion commander was moving us again. This is crazy. And then we got to go to another position and have to get that all fixed because the unit we just left hadn't done anything, and we had to fix the whole place and get that set up, and then we were going to move again. Uh, we just couldn't understand why we had to move. But in reality, I can see in hindsight the battalion commander's policy of rotating companies was brilliant. You know, he wanted to stamp out this complacency. He didn't want us to be complacent and say, hey, this is perfect, this is the best position, there's everything we should know. He wanted us to see things differently. He wanted us to continually improve. He was addressing the boredom problem and all the problems that can happen when you have bored Marines.
Right.
So it actually brilliant. But anyway, so the last time we were there, the last position we were at was the Lebanese Scientific University. So basically there was a big stretch of buildings between a slum called, but we nicknamed Cooterville, between us and the airport. But we could basically generally see where the airport was, but we were separated from the airport. As the crow flies, maybe about 2.5 kilometers, but you couldn't go through the slum. You had to take a roundabout way, so it was probably about 10 kilometers to get to the airport from our station. So we were at the Lebanese Scientific University, and we were having some firefights up there and increased indirect fire in there as well. In fact, and Mike Oiler, our forward air controller, he was up on the roof trying to spot for aviation coming in, and he was killed. He was hit by a 7.62 round right in the head, and we were not feeling too good about ourselves. But I was sleeping in the CP on a stretcher, so I could hear the radio and everything like that, about 6:30 in the morning, we heard the explosion, and so we got up and started calling the front post, trying to get a triangulation on where that explosion was.
And now, hey, Ron, can I stop your word? Now, can you explain, so for those of us that remember, there's the coastline, a couple of footnotes. First of all, explain the green line to everybody who's never heard of it.
Okay. So the green line is the side and road, and basically what happens is you look at Lebanon, Beirut is on a peninsula that juts out into the Mediterranean. The green line is a road that runs north-south from Israel all the way up to Tripoli and Sidon. So it cuts off, it goes on the eastern side of the city of Beirut. And on the right is more of a mountain, and that's on the right side, or the east of the Green Line, was the Christian. And then on the west side of the Green Line, and then further west going into the city, was more of the Muslim population.
Right.
So it was a demarcation that had separated the Christian east from the Muslim West. Well, one of the things that agreement for us coming in was that we would keep the Israeli Defense Force on the Green Line or to the east, so that they wouldn't be coming close to the Palestinian families that were left behind. So that was the purpose of the Green Line.
Okay, that's how it
is. Also known as Sidon Road.
All right, could you help us out with the geography? So you have the airport. And then you guys are at the scientific unit, Beirut Scientific University,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's about, you said, 10 clicks to the north.
Well, if you look at the airport in relationship to the city of Beirut,
right.
The airport is to the south of the main city.
Right.
And then as you go north, it gets more and more built up. It goes from semi-detached to block type construction that you get into the city.
Okay.
So the airport is along the coast, and it pretty much controlled the coastal road. And then you had a large built-up area, which I call Cooterville, right next to the airport, between the airport and the side of the road. And then the Lebanese Scientific University was along the side of the road. So you have two north-south roads, the coastal road and the side of the road. I had positions at the Scientific University,
mm-hmm.
and some checkpoints along the way on the outside of Cooterville, and then the southern part of the airfield. You basically had a line that ran east to west that served as a buffer and kept the Israeli Defense Force from coming any further west. than the Simon Road.
All right. Now, explain to us the location of where the barracks. Was it the American University? And where is that relative to you?
No, it's the Lebanese. The BLT barracks was right inside the airport itself.
Okay.
And in fact, it was the old Lebanese Aviation Administration headquarters, and it was a four-story building. And it was inside the perimeter. In fact, that was one of the things. The Lebanese Armed Forces were really supposed to be the ones providing security. Now, we had our interior security set up, and we had checkpoints, and we had entry control points. The main entry control points set up with gates and barricades and barrels and serpentine entrances. And then north of that, there were Lebanese Armed Forces at checkpoints. That would even keep anybody from coming in further. So we were pretty much that was on the interior of the airport.
So it
was behind the line.
Okay. All right. I was struggling with the geography. All right. So you're off to the north. You hear. Well, I'll tell you what, I have to take one more break, and then
sure.
And then we'll talk about that. My guest, Ron Vaskowski, we talked about the complexity, and I'll tell you what, and if you didn't have any sense of it, and you haven't read a whole lot about Beirut, you know, and what the Marines were trying to do there, and just hearing Ron explain the different positions he was at, the fire that they came under, the rules of engagement relative to engaging, and then the complexities of how the Arab fighters saw the Marines, and maybe initially as peacekeepers and a way to keep them, keep the Israelis away from them, and kind of an insurance policy against the Israelis. And then when we start shooting naval gunfire, then we get identified with the Israelis, and the Israelis is certainly not sympathetic to Yasser Arafat and what they were doing. And then, you know, once we get painted in that direction, I think the die is cast for what happens on October 23rd. So we'll talk about that next as we continue on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Don't go away. All right, we're going to take a break. You'll hear the last part of that tomorrow. Yeah, I hate to do that to you, but I forgot how long the interview was, to be honest with you. So, that is General Ron Vaskowski. And, you know, again, we had no idea what we were getting into. I mean, when we went to Beirut, you know, it's a classic case where the situation on the ground is different. You don't know it yet, but it is. You're seeing things and you're trying to respond in the context of what you understand to be the range of military operations. But those rules have changed. And so, into that, the Marines from VLT-18, went and they did their best. And, certainly, what turned out, was not, what they anticipated or certainly what they did, obviously the desired outcome. All right. So, you'll hear the rest of that tomorrow in our, we'll start at 7:30. And so Ron's, you know, again, I think it's fascinating to hear, you know, things that you think you knew about, but they're a little bit more complex. And again, to judge them on what they knew at the time is much different than to judge them through a lens after all these years of fighting Islamic fundamentalism. At that point, you know, Hezbollah, what is that? We knew who Yasser Arafat was because he was on TV. But we did not know... we did not know what it was all about. And again, just Ron says, you know, here, you know, we think the New Jersey off the coast is a good thing, but as soon as that thing lights off, we now aren't peacekeepers anymore. We are now part of the problem. And, the New Jersey, for God's sakes. Holy smokes. All right, so we'll take a quick break. Doug Lucio is going to join me here in a second. We're going to talk about, advising. He's written an article in the Marine Corps Gazette. We'll talk about that, get his thoughts on Niger, and really the difficulty that comes with advising.
in this day and age. So don't touch that dial. Doug Lucio, interesting guy, fun guy, and you'll meet him again coming up next. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts at 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Matt.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOC community should be aware of.
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit veteranscrisisline.net for free 24/7 confidential support. A
call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Ten minutes after 9. Let me read you an email. You gotta be shitting me. You got us there in Beirut, and now we're gonna stop? This better be good, Mac. I swear to God. Look, it's gonna be good. Or else, it's his ass. Joining me is Lieutenant Colonel Doug Lucio. Are you still Lieutenant Colonel? Are you selected? I'm not familiar with the intimate details of your career right now. So, first of all, welcome back to the program. And, oh my God, I didn't do... Hold on, I did do something. All right, now you're here. So, first of all, are you still a colonel? Are you still a lieutenant colonel? Are you selected for colonel?
I am still Lieutenant Colonel, Mac. You know, it's like sometimes you're just happy with what the Marine Corps gives you. And if the Marine Corps later wants to, you know, give me the opportunity to be a colonel, I'll excel. But
to be a senator.
Until then, you know, I'm happy with what, I don't know if that'll ever happen. I hate politicians.
Hello.
I love the opportunities I have.
All right. So if a colonel is a senator, then does that mean a lieutenant colonel? Are you a member of the House of Representatives? Is that where you're saying? Because I was a major, which means I was nothing. So maybe a page on the Senate floor at times.
I think it depends on the level staff you work on. Because you know if you're a battalion commander, you're the only lieutenant colonel in your entire, you know, 500 to 1,000 man organization. But if you work in the Pentagon, you know, the colonels get the coffee. So the lieutenant colonels don't even get to be in charge of that.
They don't even.
I think your status depends on where you're at.
The lieutenant colonels don't even get a crack at the coffee.
No, the colonels are in charge of getting the general's coffee at the Pentagon.
That's nice. All right. For those of you, people who don't know, you born and raised where?
Oregon. Grants Pass, Oregon.
Grants Pass, Oregon. I just watched The Postman recently. Do you identify with that movie because it takes place in Oregon? Are you a big fan of it?
I don't think I've ever seen that movie. I know it exists, but
Come on, it's an Oregon.
That is.
It's an Oregonian movie. All right, and you went to college where?
The Goonies was Oregon. I can relate to that. Tonya Harding was from Oregon. I used to watch her when she was dating, and she turned out to be a thug. So yeah, exactly. I can relate to some of that.
Wow. All right. What? Where'd you go to college?
Oregon State University, my undergrad.
Home of the Ducks. Okay, and then how's the Marine Corps?
Beavers, Mac.
Beavers. That's what I said. It gets confusing. A lot of animals up there. How did the Marine Corps get on your radar?
I think that there was a sense of a kid growing up in Oregon and outdoors, and I thought, you know, I want to be in the military. I want to do cool things. And I looked at the Army Rangers and I looked at the Marines, and I think the Marines looked a little bit more compelling to me. So.
So no,
I tried to enlist. Mom and Dad said, "Go to college, son." And back then, I did what I was told.
Yeah,
but
back in the
day. I was determined to be a Marine. I didn't think I'd do it for my career, but I definitely thought I'd do it for a little bit.
Interesting. All right. Interesting. No Marine in your background. That's interesting. All right. Tell everybody you're an artillery guy. You've done advising in your career, which we're going to talk about here a little bit, and tell everybody what you're doing now.
Yeah, I work at Joint Forces Staff College, which is one of the colleges underneath National Defense University. I teach what's called, a lot of people just refer to it as the GPME2 or the 10-week course. So we teach military planning and strategy for joint officers. So that's what I do right now.
You talk to everybody about your experience in advising.
Sure. I've had three military advisor teams. I was the team leader of each of those, and trained the Iraqi Army as well as Afghan National Army. And what I'll tell you is, you know, it's a little different and it's a little bit weird than the things that Marines do on a conventional level every day. And I honestly think it was the best assignments I ever had was go to a new country, learn a new language and culture, and go be successful. And off the grid you go, and you've got autonomy and a small group of people, and you trust each other implicitly, and hopefully you come out of there alive. And, you know, the good news is we felt, in our cases, we felt like we made a difference, both in Anbar and in Helmand.
Okay. All right. Before we talk about, you wrote an article in the Gazette called The Godfather Doctrine.
Yes, sir.
It's called Security Force Assistance Training, an offer the Marine Corps can't refuse. So before we get into that, just wanted to get your general thoughts on advising is in the news these days very prominently. Green Berets have been doing this for decades, going around the world, working with, and but when people hear special forces, you know, I think the first thing everybody's brain slews to is direct action, door kickers, Delta Force, SEALs, blah, 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 blah. And those guys tend not to do this, okay? What we're talking about is a mission the Green Berets have been, you know, been doing for a long, long time, and Special Forces guys have been doing, which is going around the world and working with the militaries of our allies, partners, and in this case, as we put pressure on Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, in their homes, they perform a activity called squirting, and they tend to go where to non-governed spaces or spaces that are friendly to them. Those spaces that are friendly to them are dwindling, and Africa is certainly one of the areas where they find less governed space. Do you have any thoughts of, as you watch this? These advisors were relatively new to the terrain, new to the villages, new to their partners. Is there a way that you do that? Do you need to use more caution? We've all learned from the news, General Dunford's press conference, that, you know, if contact is expected, they are not allowed to participate in those in those type missions. So it seems to be that part seems to be pretty straightforward. Yet there seems to require a lot of restraint in terms of. Because it's not our nature, I can tell you, that if there's contact expected, we're not going. That's not the way that you're going to find most most guys in the American military. That's not what they sign up for. So talk about managing the nuances of advising in a place like that. And I'm not asking you to comment directly on the events because none of us know the particulars of it. Just the challenge of being new. Not only to the train, your partners, and that specific mission and their strength showed in kind of an unfamiliar part of the world.
Sure. Let me give some context first on you set the table, so to speak, on direct action and other types of advising. So if I could, I'd like to start with that.
Sure.
And I'll be real brief. I mean, the way that we look at soft, for starters, is national versus theater soft. When we say national soft, that's your direct action, surgical strikes, specific targets. I mean, some of our best trained soft operators. So that's not necessarily what we're talking about. We're talking about what's called theater soft, or sometimes white soft, because we call the direct action, we call it black soft. And special forces specifically, you know, we've got special operations as an umbrella. Special forces specifically is just the Green Berets. There's also MARSOC as well as SEALs that also participate in advising as part of their core mission in countries all over the world. I mean, I think the last time I counted, SOS is in 70 to 80 countries around the world at any given time. And these are countries that be perfectly honest, if you did a, if you looked at a picture of the globe where the lights are out, you know, you could see, you know, the bright lights from big cities.
Right.
Where there's no lights, that's where these soft guys are doing, doing this work. In many cases, what we're specifically talking about is unconventional warfare. And these guys are specifically training, indigenous population to essentially rise up against tyrannical governments. So that's a very specific skill set. Growing on the wider scale, did foreign internal defense and security force assistance. There's been a lot of bleed over in the conventional forces. All the services have ponied up troops to train security force assistants. And what I'll say is, I think intentionally our bias is towards the violence of direct action because we think violence is the solution to a lot of problems. In order to be successful as an advisor, you have to learn that, and your point is correct, you know, the advisor is not the primary trigger puller. The advisor is there to train some other force to do the work and work indirectly to solve problems.
All right. Talk about the restraint that you need to show. First of all, you know, you and I have had this conversation before, but advising to me,
sure.
You know, it doesn't come without its risks. You're not among American Marines. You're not among your own kind. You're not in your own tribe. You are going to go out and you're going to live with them. And we've all seen stuff happen in Iraq and Afghanistan where a member of the unit you're with turns on advisors and kills them. So it takes a fair amount of courage just to do the mission itself, let alone to be out there alone and unafraid doing it. Talk about the restraint that you have to show, given especially the guys in Niger relative to contact, because that's not supposed to be a part of this.
Sure. You know, the tactical patience is probably one of the hardest things because I think instinctively there's a realization when you're out there by yourself in a small team, if you start a fight, you're in it until that fight ends. So you're usually not going to be in a situation where you've got a QRF that's ready to come back you up. And to be perfectly honest, that's not the mission set of these guys. The mission set is to not be engaged and to work with the community so that, you know, you're not directly getting shot at. But, you know, sometimes somebody takes a shot at you and you got to defend yourself.
Right.
So, you know, I think the term that you were describing as green on blue is when, you know, a neutral force or a force you're training shoots you, so blue being friendly. So green on blue, I mean, that was I think 2010 to 2012, there was a real big spike in that. And there was a lot of concern on how do we manage that. And, I think the long and the short of it is cultural understanding and appreciation, attunement, and just having a never let your guard down for any reason and always protecting each other is kind of, you know, what we came up with on how we solve these problems because you can never trust anybody 100% when theoretically the people that you're training could turn on you in a second and shoot you. So you always have to have somebody in a position to provide security, but you also have to walk that fine line on demonstrating trust of the people you're working. And a lot of that means you have to know their language, their culture, to be honest, the microculture, the microlanguage, and the nuance of that area and region. And yeah, that takes a long time to get smart on that, and I think when we rush it, that's when people get hurt or killed.
My guest is Doug Lucio, and we're very quickly going to talk about an article that he wrote appearing in the Marine Corps Gazette. And we're talking about the subtleties of advising, and I think that when I first heard of what happened in Niger, I made the comment that this doesn't happen without somebody on the inside letting somebody else know. There's been reporting to that effect now that the Pentagon believes that whatever village they left, there was contact between them and whoever ultimately attacked them. And so to me, that's a component of it. And the other thing in the news is that the mission may have changed once they got out there. And so anyway, as General Dunford said, you know, the investigation will extract all that information. But Lucky, before we go on, when things like that happen, I'll just speak for myself. I was pretty proud, completely unsurprised, that you had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff walk into that briefing room, do the briefing, and say, I'll be here as long as you need me here.
Sure.
Pretty impressive.
Well, I think you and I both know that people like General Joe Dunford are our national treasure. I mean, the guy is, you know, he wears his heart on his sleeve. He is truly somebody who cares, and I think that we're fortunate to have him advising on the highest levels of our government how the military should be employed. So,
right.
You know, Joe Dunford is a tremendous human being, and I think both of us have had many chances to work with and for him. And you know, when Joe Dunford speaks,
EF Hutton listens.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a big Joe Dunford fan.
All right. Let's talk about the Godfather doctrine that appears in this month's version of the Gazette. First of all, what's the genesis of the article, and why did you write it?
Okay, the genesis of the article is it was a paper I wrote while a student at Air War College, and the original version is much longer than the Gazette is going to publish, and I spent a lot of time basically stating that the Marine Corps needs to have a Don Corleone for military advising. And, you know, I look at guys like Jeff Kinney and Daniel Yu, you know, a few of the other guys that have, Mike Langley, who have military advisors who have, become colonels and generals that, you know, need to be the individual to speak up on behalf of advising within the military. And with that analogy, you know, the Michael, the aggressive, violent ones, are the ones we usually send when we start a war, but then we quickly find out that, you know, if you watch the movie The Godfather, spoiler alert, you know, guys like Sonny get whacked.
Right.
And you don't send idiots like Sonny, who are, frankly, unable to operate independently, off to go solve your problems because they're going to screw everything up. You know, the solution is you need your Michaels, and you need the guy that's got the combat experience, but also has patience and knows when to be absolutely violent. So that's the idea. And then with that idea, I wanted to tie the movie Godfather trilogy to a research paper on how the Marine Corps historically has done advising. And I did a reach back to Vietnam vets through an organization called COVANS. COVANS, Vietnamese for a friend, and interviewed, I don't know, 15 to 18 COVANS. And found they had similar experiences in terms of, in the beginning of Vietnam, the training and readiness for military advisors was a little bit of a pickup game that you just kind of, well, I think I might need this, I think I might need that. Towards the end of Vietnam, we were pretty good at training military advisors. Fast forward, we had a similar growth problem. And I'm speaking specifically for the Marine Corps. I've been told the Army had similar challenges, that we kind of had to reinvent the wheel once Iraq and Afghanistan overextended the need of soft, and there wasn't enough soft to go around. You know, that's why we started doing military advising conventionally. And that's another reason why MARSHOC was stood up in 2006, was because there was not enough soft to go around. So too much soft need, not enough capacity, so...
Okay, now, and again, when you're saying soft, you're talking about the advising branch of our special operatives.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm talking speeder soft. I'm not talking about guys that
jump out of airplanes at like
right, okay.
the middle of the night, you know, kind of James Bond, you know, kind of work their way to the target, you know. I'm talking about the guys that do the advising piece. And Africa is a classic example of growth opportunity. We've had advisors in South America and Africa for a long time. It's not in the news, because guess what? You know, if we're preventing that war from happening, there's no reason to report on it.
Not sexy. Well, you know, and again, the chairman said the other day, why are they there? Because when we do put pressure on people, we want wherever they attempt to go to be able to stand, have forces stood up that are strong and capable of dealing with them, so we don't have to go there. So it is certainly an economy of force mission in terms of standing up the forces that can plug in and receive intelligence from us and then act on it. But at the end of the day, it keeps Americans from doing that. Talk to me about the basics of the Godfather doctrine. Do we have a good enough corporate memory to do this? I had Gil Bart.
I get it.
A week ago, I did an interview with a guy named Gil Bart Barndollar. They were they supported the Georgia Rotation Battalion, and they had definite thoughts about how this stuff needs to be institutionalized, because it looks like we will only do more and more of it, giving the blueprint that was rolled out in Iraq, Syria, and the similar blueprint that is being laid down in Afghanistan relative to the Taliban. I'm curious about your thoughts on the institutionalization of that. And then I've got an email about the series, the Vietnam War, that talked to a lot of guys and talked about American advisors and things like that. So first things first, advising, are we good at it enough institutionally so that we're not making the same mistakes over and over again? Again, given the blueprints that we've seen been executed and been, you know, look, we just held the parade in Raqqa. That's pretty good. And I think we held it a little bit sooner than most people thought we would, and without the loss of very many Americans. Certainly there was a few that lost their lives and were wounded, but we've done it, you know, by and large, relative to human loss of life, pretty, I hate to use this word efficiently, but I'll use it pretty efficiently. Your thoughts?
Well, let's go back to institutional knowledge. The biggest reason on why I wanted to write this article, and you probably recall when you and I worked together at OneMap in the G3, you know, my frustration was we were tearing down all the structure to train advisors. Yeah, we're done with this advising stuff. We're done with it. We're going out of this business. And I was adamant that, you know, we not do this. And we had this cross-leveling conference. So this is when 1MAP, 2MAP, and 3MAP CGs get together with their primary staff, and they discuss topics. And, you know, fortunately, I was allowed to go because I was the current OPSO at the time for 1MAP.
Right.
And I was, you know, I got together with all the EOTG guys from the other MAPs, and we all agreed that this advising piece was on its legs, and it was, and we were stripping the capacity to continue to do this. And we were trying to bring to the attention of the leadership of the three MAP headquarters that, hey, look, if we disestablish our ability to train advisors, we're going to have to make some cold decisions in the future where we're going to have to say no when powers higher than us say, hey, we want to keep sending advisors over. And our frustration was that we saw the dismantling of the advisor structure. I mean, those of us who were advisors, it was a personal thing. So I can say with all honesty that as soon as we started to tear down the structure, then all of a sudden we started sending advisor teams back to Iraq when we said we weren't going to do that ever again. And those guys were, there was still some residual knowledge and expertise in the area, but they didn't have as easy of a go getting what they needed to be trained to get out the door. And because I've been in a joint community for the last 2 years, you know, what the Marine Corps is doing today, I couldn't exactly tell you, but I know that 2.5 years ago when I left, we saw a little bit of dismantling of military advising, and it was just like, stop, you guys, you can't take that stuff away. We need to find a way to pay the bill, keep some sort of a scoring up. I mean, we've got Nick Skigg, Marine Corps Security Cooperation Group out of, Fort Story, which is just on the street from me, and that's, that right now is the institutional knowledge for the Marine Corps, but, I'm very vocal that I think that the Marine Corps is doing the same thing that happened in Vietnam. We got rid of our advising expertise, our schoolhouses, and then down the road, you're making stuff up as opposed to doing what's proven to get guys in the proper mindset to be effective. Because you don't want the shooters to come running out the gate. You want the guy that understands the history, the culture, and it has been able to read all the TTPs from the last, in our case, we're up to 17 years now in Iraq and Afghanistan. Some of that stuff carries over to other countries, but some of this is brand new, so we need to have this stuff tailored to the environment where the advisors are going to do their work.
Okay, I'll
take a break there.
I have a whole bunch of questions here to ask you. Before I go back to them, to Vietnam and other things, the Marine Corps never likes to say no. We both know that. And
nobody likes to say no.
Right, and the guys... And
no services, period, like to say no. We all want to be relevant. But yes, the Marine Corps does not like to say no.
And when I was the OPSO at MEF Headquarters Group, we supported all these different crazy requirements at Special Operations Training Group at the time, as it was known at the time, got thrown at it, and they did their best. But you talk about an organization that was rode hard, put away wet, and it didn't seem like the Marine Corps, we were faking it with SOTG, if that makes sense. And I want your thoughts on it, because this mission, in fact, was it General Waldhauser who called all the commanders together and said, look, if you have a major in your battalion, you're good on majors. If you have a logistician in your foreshop, you're good. Everybody else it was General Tulin. Everybody else is going to go become an advisor.
Yeah.
This is phase four. This is how we convert all those casualties we suffered into something that's tangible and long-lasting. And to be honest with you, he took the division, the MEF, the MAW, he took everybody to task and said, hey, but we want to do big combat formations. When I signed up, that's not what I thought about. Where does it fit? Have we bought it? Are we still faking it? What is your assessment as the godfather in terms of this?
Well, let me put it this way. The Army has taken a different approach than the Marine Corps. The Army actually has advise and assist brigades where they've actually, out of hide, transitioned some of their structure to take on the advisor mission. And I'm not an expert on what they've done, but I do know that they've done it, which to me is pretty much what I was recommending, that we need to have some structure in place. The Army probably did more than the Marine Corps would have been capable of doing, but still, they've preserved that structure, and they've actually created advise assist brigade. And to me, that's brilliant, because if we're going to do this dangerous mission, those guys we send down range need the best we can give them. The SOP operators that do this stuff for a living, they are pretty well trained. I mean, far beyond the level of the average Marine Security Force advisor, the average soldier Security Force advisor. So the SOP guys in Africa and South America that do this for a living are pretty damn good at it. The guys that do it part-time are not as steep in what it takes to be successful. And that's why it's ever important to make sure we don't shortcut them.
Okay, I want to talk about those guys.
Sure.
And I want to talk about the Marine Corps and those guys.
Sure.
Institutionally, if we don't embrace it, and I'll draw a parallel between Wounded Warrior And so we have these incredible Wounded Warrior battalions. The infrastructure that we have, the facilities that we have. I mean, some of it is Olympic-level rehabilitation that we have. Okay, but we don't have any more, we don't have very many guys getting wounded anymore. So we have to make a decision as a Corps in terms of how do we preserve it? How do we staff it? Because at the end of the day, it's a zero-sum game. It's a zero-sum game. And so how do we do that? Well, we've chosen to send, you know, the sick, lame, and crazy so that we can maintain the infrastructure so that it doesn't go away because it's too hard to reconstitute. Should we do something similar with our advisors, or should we go down the road that the Army did and convert certain regiments, a regiment, to an advisor regiment? And if you go there, that's what we do. Your thoughts on that?
Well, if you remember when you and I came in, we had this SRIG, the Surveillance Reconnaissance Intelligence Group. You know, I'm not saying that you need to bring something like that back, but shouldn't you convert a unit, you know, battalion size unit, into an advisor unit? I don't know, a consideration. That's certainly a potential. One thing that the Marine Corps has done, to its credit, is it did award a free MOS for security force advisors. So we've at least tagged the individuals who have successfully completed this. So in the future, you know, when two blocks away from me right now, at Mar4Com, you know, they're doing the force sync right now. And,
right.
You know, all the Marine Corps is determining who's going to do what exercises and what deployments for the next year. And you know what? Some of the conversations they're probably having involves what's the capacity of advisors we need and how are we going to find these guys? Since we have MOSs, additional MOSs, we can at least pull those guys back up and say, hey, look, we want to reinvest this guy to be an advisor. So that's something good that the Marine Corps did. But in terms of the structure, I'm concerned that perhaps we're starting to cut corners because it hasn't been like it was at its height. I want to say 2012, I think, was probably the height of military advising in the Marine Corps. I want to say the throughput was probably somewhere between 500 and 1,000 a year military advisors are being generated. And that's a pretty good number. And I'm sure that the number's probably far less than that now. So I suspect that we've started to degrade already because we've taken away the expertise of that. In a way, we went away from amphibious skill sets when we started sending Marines to Iraq and Afghanistan. We got away from long-range reconnaissance skills when we stood up MARSOC because we took all of our recon guys and turned them into MARSOC, and then we lost long-range reconnaissance skills. So there's a cost. If we're going to do something else, something's going to give. And I don't think advising has been seen as valuable and that we're not putting our money on it and saying, let's do it. I mean, let's make it a skill set.
It's odd though. Again, so here's an email. Well, let me go back. I need to go back to Vietnam. Mac, I'd be curious. He mentioned Covan. I saw some of the segments in the Vietnam series that dealt with the concept of the Covan, how it was implemented. One, did Lieutenant Colonel Lucia watch? If so, what did he think? Bucky?
I've seen clips of it. I've not seen the whole series. What I'll tell you about the Covans is my takeaway from Vietnam was those that had the language experience and the language training were the ones that felt most confident and able to do their job. The ones that went straight over without language and culture felt less confident in their ability to be effective. But I did watch some of the Covan stuff, but as Marines teach themselves to do stuff, what do they think Marines are doing? Let's go to the range. Let's work on our skills shooting.
Right.
Your job's not to shoot things. You're good enough as a shooter. Do your language and culture stuff.
My guest, Doug Lucio. We got about 50 minutes remaining. Here's another email. Mac, it is concerning that there doesn't seem to be a move to institutionalize what we've learned relative to advising. And whenever we do that, we throw away valuable skills, valuable lessons learned. I would even be okay if it was assigned to a regiment as a secondary mission to train advisors. But it needs to be resident someplace. Those lessons can't go away, because when they do, we go down this road of sending people who aren't appropriately trained, and they get killed, and then we begin to dust off the lessons learned, and it's just bullshit. Your thoughts on that?
What I would say to that author's point is, we do have one place in the Marine Corps, and that's the MCSG, Marine Corps Security Cooperation Group. So they are considered the experts on security forces systems. But what I will also tell you is, they aren't enough. We used to have advisor training group in 29 Palms, California, and that was specifically focused on the Block 4 training, validation of military advisors in a combat scenario. We did away with that. The advisor training centers that used to exist in 1MAP and 2MAP largely have gone away or been slowly reduced to just a very skeleton population. It now falls under G7 under EOTG, and there is some capacity,
okay,
there,
on,
but it's not as robust as it was.
Explain EOTG, right? Because we've gone through a number of naming conventions.
Yeah, EOTG is Expeditionary Ops Training Group. So we used to have SOTG, the Special Operations Training Group, and their primary job was validation of MUs so they could go out as a MU SOC on deployment. A few years ago, there was a move to transition it to Expeditionary Operation Training Group to also cover other training other than just validating just the MUs. The MU is still their primary focus.
Right.
But there is other focus, there is other skill sets that fall in that. And with that, the nomenclature EOTG for Expeditionary Operations Training Group was born out. And it's more than just getting the MUs ready to deploy. There's other small skill sets, like these small teams that we send overseas, whether they be a Georgian liaison or whether they be a security force assistant to pick your favorite country or whatever.
Right.
It's a far bigger role than it once was.
Got it. My guest, Doug Lucio, here's another email. Are there certain things that Lieutenant Colonel Lucio thinks makes good advisors? Should you have already been in combat? Because that isn't always an option. Should you have already had command? What is the appropriate rank mix? What is the appropriate MOS mix? So look, you talk about just an advising team. What would it normally consist of? Is there a mix of MOSs? I mean, is it do you always have a communicator there? Do you always have a logistician there? Or do you have different? Do you have advisors, and then they're cross trained to the extent that they can go ahead and execute those. Those missions, although they may not be specifically school trained in that discipline.
Sure. For starters, I think, like anything the Marine Corps does, we need a task organized. So who are you advising? If you're going to be advising a certain skill set, you probably need to build people with that experience to do that. So, I mean, if you're training in an army, that's one thing. If you're training police, let's be honest, we don't have enough MPs to do that. So you could probably be a little bit more creative on your MPs. But what I'll tell you is, proven combat leadership experience, to be a military advisor, especially a combat leadership advisor, you absolutely have to have that experience. You cannot, you have no credibility unless you've done that. I mean, that would be like, I don't know, having a matchmaker is going to hook you up on a date, but that person has never had a date themselves. It's like, you need to be experienced in that realm to have your credibility. And the first things the Afghans and the Iraqis look for is our credibility. your pressure under fire when something happens, your ability to sense danger. So I'd say combat leadership is an absolute must. I would say patience and creativity is another one that I would look at, because when you look at an individual skill set, just because somebody's really good at their job doesn't mean they're going to be a good advisor. And, oh, by the way, you could have somebody being a successful advisor as long as they're a very creative individual who's very resourceful and is able to push beyond common convention and just find a way to make things happen. So those are the things I would say. And they've got to have ability to pick up foreign language and cultural attunement. If you're a person that always sees the world through your eyes, you're going to fail. To your question on what skill sets do you need, I think everybody on the team needs to be an expert plus. And what I mean by that is there's got to be an expert on comms. Somebody else needs to be his backup. There needs to be an expert on first aid. Somebody needs to be his backup. There needs to be an expert on machine guns. Somebody needs to be his backup. So you need to have skill sets you can build upon each other. I'll stop. I'll let you poke holes with that.
Let me read you an email. This is labeled Lucky. The Marine Corps disestablished a small war center, the advocate for all things irregular warfare and advising. We need to bring it back.
Yep.
And the MCTAG. What is the MCTAG?
Yep. MCTAG is Marine Corps Training Advisory Group.
Okay. Revamp the RAO program and make advisors a primary MOS. What's RAO?
Regional Affairs Officers. So people have the designation of, oh, Max speaks several languages, and he's full up on the in South America. He's a South America RAO.
Okay, all right. All right. Do you know Phil Smith?
What's that?
Do you know Phil Smith?
Phil Smith, yes.
Okay.
Phil Smith sounds familiar.
All right. No, he was CO of a 4th Marine Regiment when they were had just been stood up. He was a Grenada, Beirut guy, and great guy. I worked with him at IOC, he's a classy guy, smart guy, down to earth guy, very pragmatic, but a warfighter.
Yeah, I've heard his name for sure.
No, he's good. That came from him. So bottom line is, in terms of the Marine Corps institutionalizing it, it would appear to me we're trending in the wrong direction.
My opinion, yes. I think, you know, while we are trying to preserve structure and trying, you know, American taxpayers want to spend less money on the military, so we're all looking at taking pay cuts, and SFA and advising is not something the Marine Corps really thinks is its core, so it's not valued to the level that maybe some of our acquisition systems for the future are. And, I think that's some of the challenge.
Okay, but when I look at the world as it exists today and I look at what we're doing, our primary function in every one of these regions is advising, yes?
I don't disagree with you on that.
Well, that's because you're smart. What about talk to us about the bottom line relative to the to your article, because I want to get back to that. What is the offer?
The Marine Corps.
What is the offer that the Marine Corps can't refuse?
The Marine Corps needs to have advising. I mean, and we need to have advocates. You know, the one thing that doesn't completely come out in the article is kind of my tie through on the call to action within the Marine Corps on having somebody who is like the dawn of advising within the Marine Corps. And you know, we've got a few general officers who were advisors, and I would say, you know, perhaps one of them could be one of our starting points. We've got operation advisory groups for just about every skill set. We don't have them for advisors. And the requirement to be an advisor is your battalion commander or your squadron commander signs off on you being an advisor. Or if your battalion commander or squadron commander has never been an advisor or has a negative impression of what an advisor is, we might we might unintentionally pick the wrong characters to do that. And so I also advocate that we should have advisor boards whenever we build advisor teams, and you should pull some former advisors out to kind of screen the packets, interview the people that would potentially be sent to do that, and determine if they're the right fit. And what I mean by the right fit is somebody who's got that tactical patience, that cultural awareness and appreciation, who's got that innovation and is able to do whatever it takes to get through things, but meanwhile allowing the people they're advising to be successful. Not the one that wants to go out and only carries a hammer and everything's a nail, but somebody who looks at the world through the eyes of those we're trying to influence. Because I think that is the piece, is you have to see it through their eyes.
Advising. Here's another one. Is there any type of joint advising that gets done, or is it all SOPIPE in each service?
That's a good question. I would imagine there is joint advising because I know that there are people that are put on joint teams, especially on the national level, filling out line numbers to do a job. I have a friend, Air Force Colonel, who just came back from Iraq, and he was a MOD advisor, but he was grouped with a bunch of people he didn't know, and off you go to go learn how to be an advisor. So I suspect, in his case, he had a joint team that was made up of people from three different services. I'm not an expert on that, but yes, there is advising outside of the Marine Corps. But the joint, and all services do it, and the joint does it.
Okay, got it. All right.
My expertise is the Marine Corps, though.
Okay. Have you been involved in any discussion relative to the reexamination of the advisor function and that the Marine Corps is looking to remedy? Because, to be honest with you, the DOD budget over the course of, the last 10 years, the last 8 years, has been slashed about 20%. The Marine, all the different services have attempted to modernize at the expense of current operations and readiness. So, we're trying to fill the F-35. How do we pay for that as our budget shrinks? Well, other things don't happen. Do you know of any move afoot to address this gap in the institutional knowledge of the Marine Corps?
Specifically, I don't, because, like I said, my time right now is I've been in a joint world for the last couple of years. I have stayed in touch with other advisors and people who are, looking for that advisor experience. I did go up to a conference last year to discuss some TTPs with an organization called ALSA, and ALSA does TTPs. We talked specifically about what the role of security forces system should be in the joint environment. When I'm invited, I participate, but because I'm not in a Marine Corps world right now, I'm in a joint world. My experience, just like my concern with the overall security force expertise, it's getting stale. So, you got to keep those guys involved in your discussions, or you're going to lose what they know.
My guest, Lieutenant Colonel Doug Lucio. One final question for you, Lucky. What about advising about your article? I've been smart enough to ask you that you either want to comment on, or you want people to know
about advising.
Yeah, either about advising or what makes this little interview we've done about advising more complete?
Don't give up on the advisors and find a way to continue to use them. I know there's board precepts in the past that said, give a guy credit for not being the OPSO or XO because he did his advisor time. And I think the Marine Corps needs to continue to do that. Give those guys credit for their time away from home. I was once told that I fell out of the artillery bird nest and I was fouled by the other animals in the forest. Mike Frazier was actually the one that said that. And he said, all my time with advising made me suspect to my own community. And I know he was joking with that, but I think there's some reality to that. When you spend too much time advising and not with your core skill set, the Marine Corps is going to reward your primary skill set first, not your secondary skill set. And I understand that. That's a business decision, but,
yeah, but
you need to find ways to reinvest.
As General Tulin said, it's a bullshit position. And Frazier was just throwing the dead carcass out there in the middle of the room, right? Frazier, you know, he'll use his sense of humor, but what he's talking about is real. So you have the commanding general of one map get everybody together and say, boys, we're in phase four. All right? We have to be as aggressive and relentless in phase four. That means our best guys got to go. Okay, so
yeah, they do.
And they can't, when they come home, they can't be punished because I was not the opso of 1-4 when it sat around at barracks and then UDP'd Okinawa. I was forward with XYZ advising. I'm going to be punished for that? That's stupid. That's stupid.
Sure, and I think sometimes that does happen. But I think there's also been some cases of some battalion and regimental commanders that have been very successful, and I would argue because of the advisor experience, they've been better commanders.
Right.
Because they've realized they got to learn how to throttle it back a little bit. It's not just always about the kill, kill, kill.
No, but you and I both know it's smart guy war.
It is smart guy war.
And it's hard.
But it
makes you more reflective. It causes you, and as you said,
sure.
These guys get screened. For instance, I was told, and I don't know this to be true, and I'm going to find out shortly, that Ray Smith became fluent in Vietnamese. Okay.
I would not challenge that. I think that's probably true.
Exactly. Now, it's not a romance language for those of you who don't know that. Okay? There is not one sound in the language, the Vietnamese language, that sounds anything like what we know in Europe or in the United States. And so it gives you some sense of the intellect behind, and again, all these guys, Zinni tries to play this, you know, this Ginzo from Philly bullshit. He's one of the smartest guys in the room. Ray Smith, standing right next to him as either smarter than Zinni or as his peer, you know, and he gives you that Southern fried huckleberry bullshit. And yet these guys as full grown adults, which they say it's very difficult, are learning Asian languages. Okay, now you're supposed to be able to do that when you're younger. As you get older, it's supposed to be extremely complex and difficult. But these guys did this stuff. And so I don't know. It doesn't seem like the Marine Corps has made peace with the advisor mission, the structure that we need, so that we can, like Wounded Warrior, you know, Wounded Warrior Battalion, and the Wounded Warrior Regiments, we can add water. We have the capability. We've mothballed it a little bit. We've tweaked the way we do a certain thing so we can keep the structure there. And when we do need it, we can pour water on it, and it becomes Jell-O instant pudding. I don't know that we – it doesn't sound like to me, Lucky, that we're at the same place with advising.
Maybe not. I got a couple names for you that if you're able to get any of these guys on your show, they can also add to this conversation.
Sure.
I have some potential godfathers for military advising.
Go ahead. Who are they?
All right. So I'll start with a couple generals. George Smith, Daniel Yu, and Michael Langley. And then I'd also throw in Colonel Seth Folsom and Colonel Bob McCarthy. Those guys have all been advisors, and their experience may offer a chance for the Marine Corps to make sure the conversation doesn't die. And Colonel Folsom also published several books on the topic.
Okay. All right. Where are you headed? First, I'll explain to everybody why you think it's appropriate that you could root for two hockey teams that are in the same conference. Can you explain that to everybody?
Well, all right. When you grow up as a Devils fan, that's one thing, you know. Okay, I get it, Mac. You know, they're both doing well. So I'm a bandwagon guy. But when I spent my money in Tampa on became the season ticket holder for the Lightning, you know, I will tell you, you know, the hardest games to watch was Lightning versus Devils because, you know, it's like I was happy when one team won, but ultimately, you know, it's like, I do like two teams in the same division, so I know that you think that's against man code.
But I think. Yeah. Well, here's the best part: is you know it's against man code. but for whatever reason, you were... So when the Devils play the Lightning, you're happy when everybody scores?
Yeah, I think those are challenging games to watch because I want both... They can't both win. You know, right now, the Lightning are kicking everybody's ass, and the Devils are having the best start since they've had in probably 5 years. So, you know, I got two horses in the race, and I'm...
Right.
I know you can challenge my loyalty.
No, I don't.
I'm hoping one of them can get the cup.
Our listeners will judge you as, and that certainly is a hit against you and the law of the man. You can't do that. Okay? You can't. We all know. You can maybe have a team that you root for in the American League and the National League. Okay? In the same are they in the same division? They're not in the same division, are they?
Not in the same division. They're both East Coast, but they're both in different divisions.
All right. Well, we dodged that bullet.
Let me close the question with you.
Yes.
As we look at the World Series, is it the Whataburger or the In-N-Out Burger? Which team's going to win?
The Dodgers will continue to dismantle Houston.
Because, you know, I mean, In-N-Out Burger is a far superior cheeseburger, you know, and everybody talks about Whataburger, you know, being this great thing, you know, but
I
just wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
No, I didn't. I never equated the World Series to any type of burger.
It's a cheeseburger series.
I do believe, though, that the Dodgers will continue what they started last night in the 103-degree weather of Los Angeles in late October, which is crazy.
3-1 start, not a bad way to go.
All right. First of all, Lucky, I hope you don't mind if we continue, you know, as we continue to talk about advising, if we bring you back on, maybe do some roundtable stuff, because when you see these kind of capabilities that the Marine Corps butts into over and over again, and we don't retain somehow in cadre form the structure, some of the things Phil talked about in terms of the small war center, the McTagg and those kind of institutions, my sense is that people are going to die unnecessarily, and that makes me uneasy. And because you can go ahead and you can, to a certain extent, cadre mothball.
Yeah.
And if you've
got my article, if you look at note number 4, I list a bunch of the Vietnam vets that I talked to, and that's another element, too, is call some of those guys up because they echoed some of the same sentiments that I'm making, that, you know, we work hard to learn how to train advisors how to do things right, and then, poof, we act like we've never done it before.
Well,
that's a concern.
Right. And again, not saying no, everything's important, yada, yada, yada. But, you know, look, if you look at the strategy and what has been proven successful in Iraq, in the vicinity of Mosul, in Syria, and, you know, we're back in Helmand again advising, and in Afghanistan in general, the blueprint from the Pentagon, from guys we know, is this. We are not going to take the lead. We've been developing these forces. We're going to sustain them with supporting arms. And we'll push our advisors out to do that. But the fighting will be done by somebody else. And we're at the point where in both theaters, that can be done. If we do that, we can have a sustained presence there because we're not taking American casualties and that story is not hitting the American public in the face. So we protect our strategic center of gravity, which is the television sets that bring that stuff into the American living room on a nightly basis. And yet we're still able to continue to pursue our strategic goals in different parts of the world into phase 4 and hopefully fashion good outcomes, in Afghanistan. It would be forcing the Taliban to the table. And Rex Tillerson was just there saying, hey, look, if you're part of moderate Taliban, there's a place for you here. And so what is the mechanism that we're going to achieve that? That is through advising. And yet it doesn't seem like the Marine Corps has made peace with it.
Let me give you one anecdote on it. I know we're running out of time, but there was a guy in... All right. You run out of time? All right. I'll save it then.
No. It's my time. Go ahead, my friend.
It's your time. But you know, the anecdote I'll give you is we had a guy in Helmand who everybody wanted me to meet with him so I could clone his cell phone. And I refused to do it because they were looking at it from the, well, he's on the red cell list. We want to take this guy out. Instead of cloning his phone, I invited my MARSOC buddies. I held a banquet for him. I treated him like a completely honored guest. I turned him over to the SOC guys, gave him face, and then they met with him separately at a different time. But to do that, I had to kick all my lieutenants out because they all thought it was crazy to be meeting with the Taliban. The guy was looking for the better deal. Do I go with the Taliban? Do I go with Jarola? And had we seized his cell phone and cloned it, he would have gone with the Taliban. I handed him over to my SOC friends, and I guarantee you they had some quality conversations with him. And that's how you think like the Godfather. That's how you think like Michael Corleone. You know, Michael Corleone. Fredo would have killed the guy.
Fredo would have screwed it up. Sonny, 50-50 shot at getting it done. But Michael, as he's...
Fredo would have... Michael, Fredo would have made a move for the guy's girl.
Yes, exactly. And then got drunk and screwed that up.
Exactly.
All right.
But that's that. You don't get to that unless you have the training and the tactical patience. That's my concern. I don't want to lose what we've built.
The one more email. Joint AFPAC, AFPAK. Hands
required. Yeah, it's probably AFPAC hands. Yeah, guys that are dedicated to
hands required.
Tours in Afghanistan, and Pakistan.
Required all services to have advisors in 2009. USMC right. Killed its participation in 2014. Head in the sand.
Right.
Head in the sand.
I remember asking orders for it, and they said no, we're going to kill the program.
Well,
I asked for orders for that program.
Ugh. Okay.
Lucky. Yeah.
Thanks for the visit. Thanks for it's honestly, I mean, we're kind of exploring the whole advisor thing, not only historically but in terms of contemporary because it is the single greatest mission that you have Americans in harm's way devoted to right now. And I know we hear all the saber rattling from the Korean Peninsula, but if you want to know what's really going on, it is advising. And the Marine Corps has I don't want to say turned its back on it, but it's made a conscious decision that I guess we'll continue to fake it. And I think there's enough people that believe that going into the future with this quote-unquote generational conflict with Islamic fundamentalism that is described as a generational conflict, possibly a multi-generational conflict.
But it's a multi-generational conflict.
Yeah, it might be something that we ought to revisit because it looks like the blueprint for success in the future.
Sure.
In the future. So, anyway. All right, sir.
I'll be running my mouth on this topic for forever. So,
all right.
Even when I retire and go become Professor Lucio, I'm
Professor
still going to be talking about it. I know. Crazy to think about that in the future,
it's entirely predictable. The article is called The Godfather Doctrine. His name is Douglas G. Lucio. What's the G stand for?
Gerard.
Nice.
Not a common name, but
No, it's not. And you can find it on the Marine Corps Gazette website, The Godfather Doctrine. So, Lucky, thanks for the visit.
Thanks, Matt. Good talking.
All right. There you have it. Doug Lucio. Roots for two hockey teams. Unbelievable. He's a good dude. He's better than a good dude. He's a great guy. And unselfish guy. And really has put a lot of time and effort into the whole advising thing. And you can hear the passion that guys who have been a part of it speak to it. But the Marine Corps... we fake it on occasion, and again, it's a capability that we need to be resident. So again, we'll continue to talk about it. And we're out of time, if you can believe that. Yeah, go figure. My thanks to Ron Baskowski. You'll hear the final installment of that interview tomorrow. And for those of you that listen, if you didn't listen to it, you'll hear... you'll hear him talk here pretty quick about Beirut and You also hear him talk about contemporary events from a year ago when we did the interview. But you hear about the complexity of events, you know, walking into something that you may or may not be prepared for, the subtleties of the mission of peacekeeping. Again, we talked about the subtleties of advising, but the subtleties of peacekeeping. And Ron Baskowski, good dude. Thanks to you for listening. This program repeats itself momentarily. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Don't be afraid to turn off the news. On a Wednesday, All Marine Radio. Over and out.